If the committee will please come to order. My apologies for the delay. I appreciate everyone's patience. Our agenda today has drawn many interested parties. We're covering a number of different issues. We have 1.5 hours to hear everyone, which should be more than enough time to cover the four bills in our possession today. To ensure that everyone on all issues has had enough time to present their side, we've developed some simple rules and time constraints, and my belief is that these have been communicated to both sides previous to the hearing. The time limits were developed after testifiers started to contact my office to present, and they reflect the amount of time and debate and testimony we expect for today's bills. The first two bills, House File 2100 and House File 934, both were heard in committees last year. They will be allotted 10 minutes split between supporters and opponents for their hearing. The third and fourth bills, which are new bills introduced only this session, House Files 3533 and 3511, will each be allotted 30 minutes to be split between supporters and opponents. With that, Representative Clark, welcome to the committee. Representative Lane, would you like to move House File 2100 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
Yes, Mr.
Chairman. Mrs. Clark, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is about ensuring that Minnesota children have safer products. We call it the Safer Baby Products Bill because actually we're dealing with very young children. In the interest of time, let me just say that this bill was heard last year. It was turned into a study that then did go to the conference committee but was not funded. So what we have in that year's time is a lot more research and work around the state and around the country. And the bill that you have before you has the amendment, Mr. Chair, if you would move it. It ends in DE7.
Representative Clark, the DE7 or the DE5 is the one that I have in my possession for House File 2100.
DE7.
DE7.
Thank you. All right. The chair moves the H2100 DE7 amendment to put the bill in the order the author prefers. Any questions to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, I did provide three amendments, three changes that could be an oral amendment to the staff, it occurs in three different places. The one word needs to be changed, and if you can read that to you.
Ms. Newman, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair and members, this is an amendment to the DE7 amendment. On page 2, line 3, strike the word person and insert manufacturer. Page 2, line 13, strike person and insert manufacturer. Page 2, line 15, strike or a container. Page 2, line 17, strike person and insert manufacturer.
I want to assure that all members have a copy of the DE7 amendment before them. You found it. Okay, very good. Representative Schmansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want clarification on the third amendment once more.
The third one was on page 2, line 16, to strike the words or a container.
Does everyone have those four oral amendments to the DE7 amendments? Any questions to those? Seeing none, again, this is an author's amendment to get the bill in the form the chief prefers. All those in favor, the chair will move those amendments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark, see your bill is amended.
Thank you, sir. And we're going to offer some testimony today, and I'm going to start with the things you've done.
Hi, thank you for having me here today. My name is Lindsay Bell, and I'm the coordinator for Healthy Legacy. I'm just going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to talk through the bill really quickly, and while doing that, create some sort of context for our discussion about the bill here today. Again, my name is Lindsay Dahl, and I'm here with Healthy Legacy. We are a statewide environmental health coalition that is working to eliminate toxic chemicals from our everyday products. So, like I said, in the interest of time, since this was heard last year, I'm going to just talk through, and I'll take any questions afterwards. We'll start with section one is just the definition to clarify what the six different types of phthalates are that we're talking about here today, what a child's product entails, etc. And to jump into the meat of the bill, we'll start with section two. It addresses bisphenol A. Bisphenol A is a hormone-disrupting chemical that's used in polycarbonate plastic. So it's a building block of polycarbonate plastic. And in relation to what's relevant to the bill, it's used in baby bottles, sippy cups, and the formula can linings of used for infants. Bisphenol A is found to leach into liquids when it's say a baby bottle is heated, cooled, scratched, worn, or gets older with age. And bisphenol A has been linked to several health effects in peer-reviewed studies. Over 150 peer-reviewed articles have found that low doses of bisphenol A has been linked to several health effects, first of which includes hormone disruption, since it is a synthetic estrogen. Second of which, abnormalities of the male reproductive tract, early onset of puberty in females, prostate cancer, breast cancer, miscarriages, diabetes, and obesity. So section two is addressing a phase out of bisphenol A from children's products ages 0 to 3. We're specifically talking about children ages 0 to 3 since they are the most vulnerable among us. Pound for pound, children 0 to 3 eat more, they drink more water, and they breathe more air. Moving on to section three, it addresses phthalates. There are six types of phthalates that are used in children's products, and phthalates are used, they're plasticizers. So they're used in PVC plastic, teething rings, rubber duckies that I have here today, bibs, and they're also used in fragrances. And phthalates have been also linked to adverse health effects in peer-reviewed literature in both animal and human data for phthalates. And some of the health effects are included decreased testosterone levels in males, smaller penis size, undescended testicles, the feminization of the male reproductive tract. And so what this means is a decreased anogenital distance, the distance between the scrotum and the anus is smaller, and damaged sperm and asthma and rhinitis. So the section three is talking about phthalates, a phase out by the date January 1st, 2009. And I just want to point out that date was specifically chosen because Governor Schwarzenegger signed into law a ban on phthalates in children's toys in October of 2007. And the California legislation uses that same date. So manufacturers are already reconfiguring as we speak to meet that date. So for the sake of having everything kind of on the same page, that is why that date was chosen. The section four, I just want to highlight, is specifically put in here to look at as we replace these chemicals and we look at safer products, we want to make sure that these products and chemicals are safe. They're not carcinogens, mutagens, or reproductive toxicants. So this language is specifically put in there to make sure that happens. And then finally, section five is just permissive language. So as other states, currently there's 11 states working on that have pending legislation on phthalates. There's 11 other states that have pending legislation on bisphenol A, some of which those states overlap. But as all these states are looking to address the chemicals in our everyday products, hopefully down the road we can have some sort of interstate clearinghouse to share information on the different profiles of these chemicals. And yep, I'm just going to quickly wrap up here. I just want to highlight in regards to phthalates, California, like I mentioned, has phased them out. They're banned in the entire European Union, which constitutes 27 countries, in addition to 14 other countries, including Japan, Mexico, Fiji, and Argentina. And then specifically, we're talking here about children, as I mentioned before, and we're talking about low doses because, again, the peer-reviewed science shows that low doses do matter and have long-term chronic effects. I just want to wrap up by showing you guys the essence of this bill can really be described in these two different rubber duckies, and we can draw the same parallels for bisphenol A. But on the left here, I have a rubber ducky that's made out of PVC plastic, and it contains phthalates. and the one here on my right does not contain phthalates. This one is sold in the United States. This one is sold to European markets, and they were both made in China. So the kind of moral of the story is that safer products exist. They're already on the market today. We just need to make sure that manufacturers are using the safer products. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dahl. Representative Clark, do you have other testifiers?
I do.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, my name is Can you hear me? I moved to Woodbury from the European. It's Lisa Salt Rasmussen.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I moved to Woodbury from Denmark in the European Union 6 months ago, and with our infant daughter who is now a year. And I have, in all this time being pregnant and so on, been very interested in the world around us and the chemicals that we know more and more about. But for me, who is not a chemist and doesn't have a clue about chemicals in on labels and table of contents, the world of consumer products is a jungle, and I would like to be able to go into a store and have confidence in the products that I am buying is safe for my family. I believe that I had that confidence in Europe. I don't have the experience of having that confidence here. In the European Union, as you just heard, phthalates have been banned from children's products since 1999. I am, of course, very excited about living here, and it is a great experience, but I would wish for that I could trust the products I buy here for my family. And that is why I am speaking in support of the bill before you today. There are safer alternatives. Companies who produce for the European market and also for the American market could abide by the European standards, but produce something else for you here. So I would think it was a good idea to align these double standards.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
My name is Beth Fondell, and I'm here today representing the work and position of our Greater Twin Cities in support of this particular bill. And in partnership with our other state and national chapters, the mission of the ARC is to support children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in accessing healthy and productive lifestyles. So our chapter supports over 320,000 people each year impacted by the presence of a chronic long-term intellectual disability. And our concern, why we are supporting this particular bill, is that at this time, most of you are already aware that the rates of children in special education services is growing disproportionately every year. Between 1977 and 1994, the number of special ed students increased 191% on a national level. Special education services are costly, and supporting this bill, it might be possible to save some valuable state resources if we work towards preventing some of the conditions resulting in the need for special education services. I'm shortening my testimony here in the best interest of time, but phthalates and bisphenol A and PDE, which you will hear in the next bill, they're low-hanging fruit because there are already safer alternatives on the market. And if we can promote things that interrupt hormone-disrupting potential in children, that this is in the best interest of all of us. So please consider supporting this bill.
Thank you. Questions for either the author of the bill or any of the testifiers? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions again, would somebody again speak to the January 1st date? And again, confirm in my mind that that is a realistic, that's only 6 months away by the time we get out of here. So.
Thank you.
Ms. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reason the date was chosen, like I mentioned, was because that's the date that California passed, and the manufacturers didn't bring up any problem with the date, as far as I'm concerned. It's or as far as I know, it went in regards to California. Another reason that data is realistic is because Toys R Us recently came out and said that none of the toys on Toys R Us shelves can contain phthalates, and they give a similar time frame. So realistically, they're already going to be having to moving at that quick pace, and we're just kind of adding to that momentum.
Representative, okay.
I was doing fine until you said made in China. And we all know what happened to dog food last year. What is the, what's the safety net to assure our consumers that, in fact, the restriction is being adhered to?
Mr. Chair, well, and just the issue, the reason I brought up China, just so you know, is to show that the manufacturers in China are making both the safe and unsafe products. And are you talking specifically about an enforcement piece here in Minnesota?
Yeah. Who's doing the assurance that that product does meet the standard to which it's being represented?
That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, if there's no specific enforcement piece in this piece of legislation, and that was intentionally done just because we don't have the capacity in our state agencies currently to fund them to do this enforcement piece. So what it really is it's a first step, and hopefully we can come back in future years.
Other questions for the testifiers? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 2100? Going once, going twice. There are there's quite a packet in members. Packets of documents both in support and in opposition to House File 2100. Any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure if anybody else was going to come up here. I have a couple of questions, and hopefully Representative Clark would be able to answer these. How long have these chemicals been used in manufacture of these products?
Representative Clark.
My understanding is we're talking about the 1930s and the 1950s, the accumulated 30s and the 1950s.
Okay. And
Representative Anderson.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what you had mentioned, your testifier mentioned earlier a peer review study saying that this has effects on reproductive organs, especially in boys. Could you tell me what is that based on, considering that these products have been used since the 1930s and 50s?
I'll have to give you the citation.
Ms. Dahl.
Thank you. The studies are coming specifically looking at animals, and the reason, well, these chemicals, bisphenolide, for example, was introduced in the 30s. It was used as specifically as a synthetic estrogen. It wasn't used in toys. It was used for to help women's ability to conceive, and they realized that it probably wasn't the best use of that chemical. And so the chemical was never tested for its use in toys, and they started using it later. But all the peer-reviewed science is specifically looking at, for bisphenolide, for example, lab animals. And that's where they found the health effects. And, yeah, let's leave it at that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the peer review scientists, they were made up of whom?
Representative Nizal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson. Scientists from all across the world, mainly university, and over 90% of the peer-reviewed scientists were government-funded. Most of them are coming out of universities. University of Missouri, for example, is really known for their bisphenol research. They're kind of the world's leader, with a doctor there named Dr. Fred Lomsdahl.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, earlier you had also mentioned comments about the temperature bottles being heated up and that's when the leaching would occur. Mm-hmm. At what temperature would that be?
Ms. Dahl?
I don't know off the top of my head. I actually can look it up if you want me to.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. And not to jump around, sorry, Mr. Chair. I had also a comment. This is dealing with fire retardation or retardants that are used. Have we had any comments from the fire chiefs at all and what their views are on this issue at all?
Mr. Chairman, that's the next one.
Oh, that's the next one? Okay. Okay. I see, I knew I was getting them confused
we'll,
here.
We'll come back.
Awesome.
All right. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a letter in my packet, I assume it's in everyone's packet, from a Julie Goodman, PhD, DABT, whatever that means. And several questions I have on this, because in the first full paragraph on the second page, the last sentence, it says that this has not been banned by any government body in the world, but I've heard reference to Governor Schwarzenegger in California. So which is true, that it's not been banned by any government body, or that California has? This is dated February 28, 2008, so would have had to happen today.
February
29th. This testimony, I believe, is specifically referencing 15OA, and the California ban was on phthalates. So the two different chemicals. She's specifically talking about...
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, then maybe I'm confused, because this letter is referencing House File 2100. That's the one we're on, correct?
That is the one we're on. That's correct.
Also claims that the European Food Safety Authority and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration doesn't have a problem with it. And the reason I bring this letter up is more because of... Oh, and I see our counsel has left the room, but... In the delete all amendment they're working on, several places it says the legislature finds that whatever that word is. I don't know that. I don't like that phrase that the legislature finds. I didn't find anything. Is there a group we put together that found this, and now we are the authority over that group, so we have found this? I'm real nervous about that phrase, because I don't think the legislature has found anything. We're listening to testimony from people that say one thing or say another thing. I don't know if counsel could change that at some point in time, but I don't like that. And again, this letter here is saying that if this is not disapproved by any drug authority anywhere in Europe or here.
Representative House, I can provide two comments to assist. Again, the House File 2100, the DE-7 amendment, deals with both bisphenol A and phthalates. And I think that may be causing some confusion here, is that it's dealing with two chemical compounds. The letter that you've referenced deals with only one of those. Secondly, the chair is not a fan of legislative finding statements cluttering up statute either.
I might just say, when we have findings in legislation, part of the function is to really provide information about scientific data. In this case, that is new and not known by the general public, and certainly by legislators. I mean, this has been an education experience for me to learn a lot about this. So it's helpful, I think, in that regard to have findings. It doesn't mean that we have a special committee. It means that we are affirming that, I think, 90% of the research out there backs this up, and I've always liked those kinds of statements, because they do help legislators understand the context. It's not essential to the bill, but it is, I think, a very helpful context. And I guess I would just say, if there's a desire of the chair of it to change that, I'm wondering if we could do it at the next committee level, just so that there would be the opportunity for people to have that.
Representative House, I forget. Do you sit on full commerce?
No, I do not.
That's right. That's what I thought.
But if you tell me that you would change that in the next level, I'd be okay with that.
Is that acceptable, Representative Clark, rather than doing it on the fly here this morning?
But I appreciate that. I do have one follow-up comment.
Certainly, Representative House.
All the studies and the scientific research, I'm really still looking for it. I'm finding a nice brochure, but I'm not finding any scientific data. And at least I do have a letter from a PhD who's very knowledgeable and has done many studies, and with the claims of the Food and Drug Administration and the European Food Safety Authority that this is not a problem. Mm-hmm. I don't see any studies in saying it is a problem, so I would have to, at this point, vote no.
Ms. Dahl, you wish to respond?
Thank you. I have several of kind of the leading studies here. If you want me to circulate them, I can. If that would be useful. And second of all, if I can just address the FDA piece that you mentioned in the letter from Dr. Goodman, I would just like to point out that the FDA uses a reference dose that was from the 80s for bisphenol A. 1980.
Any other questions? Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question in regard to toy quality. For example, you held up the rubber duckies. You know, there are different levels of toy retailers that offer toys. Do you have any evidence that there are safer toys in higher-end retail shops as opposed to lower-end mass production type of thing? Or is this phthalates in evidence in across the board, no matter what quality of toy shops?
Rudolph?
Thank you. They're found in all sorts of toy shops. It's all across the board. It doesn't necessarily correlate to which products are more expensive or which toys are higher quality. They're found all over.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. So is it more expensive to manufacture the toy without the phthalates?
Ms. Dahl.
Thank you. When we looked at when Europe phased these out, they found that they weren't more expensive and they weren't more expensive on the shelf.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Procedural question. I think I'm a co-author, but I think I'm a co-author on the original 2100, which was the study.
Right.
And so I am now a co-author of a delete all that says, uses the word thou shalt not use it anymore. Is that correct?
That's not manufactured to sale in Minnesota.
Okay.
Representative Peterson.
So it has changed. It changed dramatically from the bill that I co-authored.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And whatever you want to do with that is
just... No, I'm not. I'm just making sure I understand what I'm doing.
You know, the term roller
always sometimes hates.
The term roller coaster was used yesterday by the speaker in referencing the state's budget experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad term for the legislative process in general.
Okay.
Seeing no fruit.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative House.
Staff is working on an amendment. If it only takes a moment.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to make copies. I think there's 5 studies here. I'd be glad to make copies of these available to all the members of the committee that are interested. And you can just have them at my office. And if you'd like to pick them up and look through them, you'd be more than welcome.
Thank you very much. We'll wait and allow Ms. Newman to do her magic here. Ms. Newman.
The amendment would be page 1, delete lines 22 to 26. Page 2, delete lines 1 and 2. Page 2, delete lines 7 through 12. And then the subdivision would be renumbered. And that effectively takes out the two findings statements.
Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that if that's the desire, that be delayed so that the next committee can look at it. I'll leave it to the committee. I think it's helpful. I think you probably found it helpful to be able to read that and see why the world is there before you, what the findings are. So. It explains a lot. We can take more testimony time to do that kind of thing in the next committee, but if everybody wants to be there, if you want to take it out in that committee, then that would be my request.
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, normally I would say yes right away. I'd like to offer the amendment. You can, when you go to the next committee, you can bring more information and show that was in the bill prior, and if that committee wants to put it back in, I think if this committee is so inclined to accept my amendment, I think this is the time to finish that work and let the next committee do whatever work and magic they want to do with it. But I think I would like to at least have an opportunity to vote on that and change it to the way I could be more comfortable.
Representative House moves the oral amendment provided to us by counsel. The author has agreed to have this language removed at the next committee. Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Benson.
Would you explain that again?
Certainly. Well, Ms. Newman, would you review again, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson.
I know what the reasons are.
Would you clarify?
And whether this is being removed now, and whether Representative Clark agrees to the removal now, or is it to be removed at the next level?
My understanding of the conversation is that Representative Powers raised concerns about the findings language in the delete all amendment. The chair did as well. Representative Clark agreed to have it removed at the next committee, but is asking that that language travel to the next committee, be before them, and then removed on an amendment at that time.
Okay.
Everyone looks properly confused. Representative Peterson.
Sorry. Ms.
And then Representative Horn. Representative Peterson.
Interpretate the vote. If we vote A and A, I and A, what does it mean?
The chair's understanding is that an aye vote would remove the finding language at this point. A nay vote would maintain the delete all amendment as it currently stands before you.
And what is the author recommending?
The author has agreed to have this language removed at the next committee, not at this committee.
So the author is suggesting a no vote?
Yes, that's... Representative Hornstein.
Well, thanks. I speaking up, let me clarify that, because I will vote no. I think that it's important to have context for what we're doing here, and I hope that maybe between now and the next committee that can be worked out, but I think as it travels out of this committee, I would prefer to have that context remain in. So,
Mr. Representative Powell.
I'll only do this on February 29th. I will withdraw my amendment.
We'll look forward to 4 years from now. Thank you, Representative Powell.
Thank you.
Discussion or questions to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Lane moves a motion that House File 2100 as amended. Pardon. Representative Lane moves a motion that House File 2100 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Clark, your next bill, House File 934. Representative Hornstein, would you like to move that before the committee?
Yes, I will move the bill, and I believe there's also a DE6. Is that correct?
So Representative Hornstein moves that House File 934 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce on Committee and Labor. And Representative Hornstein also moves the H934 DE6 amendment to be before the committee. Representative Clark. That first 10-minute bill took about a half an hour, just if anybody, for those who are keeping track in the audience. Representative Clark, is the DE6 amendment your amendment to get the bill in the order you prefer?
It is, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark to the DE6 amendment and House File 934 is amended.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, this is the bill that deals with toxic flame retardants, and I'll just remind you that in 2007, this legislature did pass a phase-out of two of the toxic flame retardants, that's called Penta and Octa, and we asked the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to come back and report to us after they had met with stakeholders in January on the DECA portion of toxic flame retardants, and that's what you have before you now. I'm going to have a witness go over some of what was in that report and just verify that this DECA flame retardant is causing widespread pollution in Minnesota, shown in numerous places. And what we're doing in this bill is a limited phase out of DECA so that we can reduce the home exposures and better protect, especially children. And this would phase the DECA out in electronic enclosures, textiles, and mattresses for home use. Other uses are not included. So I'm going to ask for a brief presentation there that you'll be able to see on the monitors and introduce Kathleen Schubert to and lead us through that.
Dr. Schuller, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm not a doctor. I'm a master of public health.
Close, but no cigar.
Just to be accurate. Would it be helpful to walk through the amendment real quickly first before I start? My presentation is going to be pretty quick.
I like quick.
Okay. So basically, you see the language that was passed last year, which was a penta and octa band. And it's a broad band with limited, with a number of limited exemptions. So when you go to subdivision 3, this is what we're deciding today. The amendment before us is a phase-out of DECA, the third form of these brominated flame retardants. And rather than a whole list of exemptions, it's a limited phase-out. It's limited to television and computer enclosures, upholstered furniture and textiles intended for home use, and mattresses. The only exemption is for used goods, so used goods that are out there in secondhand stores and so forth could still be used, and that in-state retailers in possession of products could continue to sell their stock of goods. There's an extensive exemption process, so if there are manufacturers who feel that they can't phase it out for various reasons, they can apply to the Pollution Control Agency for an exemption. And in Subdivision 5, there's language that the Pollution Control Agency suggested. Actually, this is wrong. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong amendment. I'm sorry. In the D6 amendment, this is some language that the Pollution Control Agency suggested for dealing with the fees to give them some flexibility. And then the final section deals with the participation in the interstate clearinghouse. Ms. Dahl mentioned that this is a way for state agencies to share information as they're regulating toxic chemicals. It doesn't exist yet, but it gives our agency permission to participate in that. So, all right, I'm going to go through my PowerPoint really quickly.
Thank you, Ms. Schuller.
This slide, Representative Clark already talked about that. This is what we're proposing. We're exposed to flame retardants when we eat meat, fish, and dairy products because these chemicals build up in the food system. We're also exposed through dust inhalation. These chemicals cross the placenta and affect infants, children who are more susceptible. DECA was found in the vast majority of cord blood samples, and U.S. women have much higher levels of these flame retardants in their breast milk compared with European women. About 5% of women have levels in their bodies that have been shown to cause problems in laboratory animals. So we did a body burden study here in Minnesota, and Representative Madora participated, and she's going to talk about her experience. Everybody that we tested, 35 people had these flame retardants in their body, and 34 of them had DECA in their body. We're more concerned about babies. The EPA's proposed reference dose, which is their safe dose for DECA, for oral ingestion, that is when little kids put their fingers in their mouths, the dose they're proposing is close to the dose of the exposure that's out there right now based on what kids are exposed to in dust. There's many studies in animals showing that DECA is a neurotoxin. It caused permanent changes in the brain that just don't get better. They're permanent and they can worsen with age. Safer alternatives are available. About 95% of computer companies have already phased out DECA, and more than 50% of TV manufacturers have also phased it out. And you have a handout in your packet showing the leading companies that have already phased out. These are some of them. And as far as use in textiles, DECA is not widely used in home textiles. It's not widely used in mattresses, but we're trying to prevent future uses. That's why we put it in our bill. We're trying to prevent these home exposures. And 60% of the bedding manufacturers, those four companies highlighted there, are 60% of the mattress market, and the leading 15 mattress manufacturers do not use brominated flame retardants. They use a fire blocker, which is a barrier technology, and they use alternative chemicals. And the Pollution Control Agency report, basically this is a quote from their report saying that fire safety standards can be met without the use of DECA. And the fact that there's a choice between public safety from fires and public safety from toxic chemicals. It's a false choice. We can ensure fire safety without the use of DECA. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clark, or is it Representative Medora at this time? Welcome back.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today, I'm here to speak about my experience in participating in this study. I was first approached to do this because, as you all know, I have two children with neurological-based disorders and no known cause. So, as a parent, I've been very concerned with these issues for a number of years. And when I was approached by the agency if I would like to participate, I said, absolutely, I've never done this kind of testing before. So I went ahead and did it, and quite honestly, I expected it to come out with no findings that were significant. I tend to keep a very clean home using very natural cleaning products. I don't regularly engage in activities where there would be a lot of chemicals, or so I thought. However, right before we did the study, I participated. I was doing some modeling and moving around my children's bedroom. So I was sleeping on a couch for about 3 weeks while I was doing painting and cleaning and that sort of thing. And I took the test about 3 weeks later after I had done that, and lo and behold, these two chemicals were through the roof on my report. And we couldn't, and when Kathleen, when Dr. Schuler contacted me about it, and she said, you know, these are the results, and these are what, I said, how could I have done this? I have no idea. How could I have come in contact with this? Well, that was when we found out that the cushions on my couch were for the primary, what we feel at the time to be the primary culprit for bringing these chemicals. And so it was, that means it was absorbed in my skin. So it's a very, it just shocked me. And as we continued to process through more of this information, I learned more and more. And then also the number of the neurotoxins, how high these neurotoxins are in women who breastfeed. Well, that was my situation also with both of my children. So at this point, I think it's somebody like myself who has no idea, I'm not somebody who would normally be out there engaging in all of this, but once I discovered it, I don't microwave with plastic. You know, I heard about that in the early 90s. I don't do that. I don't do other things that normally would preclude you to think, well, of course she would have these toxins. The fact that I have such high levels through a very innocent, I had no idea that sleeping on the couch could cause these chemicals to be absorbed in my body. I think it raised my awareness level to a whole new level here. So I would like to encourage the committee to think about that. Just how frequently you're coming in contact and you don't even know. It's a scary place to be.
Thanks, Representative Medora. Representative Anderson? Representative Anderson?
I'm sorry.
Anderson, not Peterson.
I distracted her, Mr. Chairman. I said, I'm going to tell my wife to quit making me sleep on the couch.
it's been a rough week, Representative Peterson.
The song is, Mr. Chairman, a country western song, There Ain't No Easy Horses, You Just Got to Learn to Ride.
There you go. Representative Anderson, you had questions on this bill previously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, can you tell me what other states have this in place?
Representative Clark?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr.
There are two states that have passed bans on DECA, Washington and Maine.
Representative Anderson.
I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Kathleen Schuler.
Ms. Schuler, can you tell me when they had these in place? When
Ms.
did
Schuler.
They pass these?
These bans were passed in 2007.
Ms. Schuler, and have they been enacted? Have they started yet, or what was the start date for them?
Ms. Schuler.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the start date for the Washington bill was 2010, but there is a state agency action required before it's implemented. And the date for Maine, there were two dates. Part of it was 2010 and part of it was 2012. But I forget which one. I have copies of the bills.
Mr. Chair, and then are there... of these items, the televisions that are out there, the furniture, computers, are there currently products that are made without these chemicals present?
For sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there are. The problem is when you go out to a store, you don't know because they're not labeled, and a lot of times the retailer doesn't know. I had a friend that was trying to buy a TV at Best Buy, and nobody at Best Buy knew anything about brominated flame retardants. So as consumers, we don't really know what we're buying. If you buy a TV in Europe, you're pretty sure that it doesn't have brominated flame retardants in it.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Shuler, does that in, is this one specific brand, or is it across all the brands that are offered that offer these non polybrominated items?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, we have a list of companies, some of the ones that I had on my slide, that we know have phased them out. But the problem is that information isn't available to most consumers unless they research on the Internet or, you know, go to our website or something. They're really not going to know because it's not labeled, and a lot of times the retailer doesn't know.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Shuler, so can you tell me, does Sony or what are some of the other television, RCA, Magnavox, or do they currently offer?
Some of them do, and actually in your packets, there's a list of electronic manufacturers that have phased out DECA, so that's available to you in your packet.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Shuler.
Any further questions, Representative?
I do. Just one more.
Please.
And this is for Representative Clark. Have you had conversations with the Fire Chiefs Association, and do they have comments about this at all?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, last year I talked with both firefighters and fire chiefs, and I think you should have a letter in your packet from the Minnesota firefighters strongly in support of this bill. In fact, they provided a letter also to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and said it shouldn't be phased out, it should be banned immediately. They were very strong in this because they understand that when we have a fire with toxic flame retardants in the property, it's a huge hazard to firefighters. The fire marshals, or not fire marshals, but the fire chiefs, I think you referenced, I did meet last year with the lobbyists for them, and at that point I think they were still deciding. My understanding is that they have opposed this legislation in other states, and we could have some conversation about in whose employ they were speaking if you want, but I can just tell you that the firefighters have been very clear with us. The fire marshals, I think you should probably ask them to address that issue directly because I don't have a letter of opposition from them. Anything like that. We've been working with them and talking with every single person who lobbies for them.
Representative Clark, I don't believe that the letter you referenced from the firefighters made it into the packet. We're not aware of that here at the front, but
okay, well,
perhaps you could make that available.
We get it.
Thank you.
And they testified last, they were supportive last year, and then they put it in writing, and so I'm so sorry that's not in there. I thought we had gotten that to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I would just like to know, is it more expensive to manufacture the product without the PBDEs?
Representative Ms. Shuler.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in some cases, most of the alternatives are cost competitive. In some cases, they cost a little bit more. For example, in a television, it's estimated that it will cost a few dollars more for a several hundred dollar television. So it adds a little bit of incremental cost, but not significant.
Representative Clark, the chair has been corrected. The letter from the firefighters is, in fact, in the packet. My apologies.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Other questions for the author or the testifiers in support? Seeing none, on the list we have Mr. Dan Hall and Mr. Steve Mackey, who've asked to testify in opposition. If you'd please come down, introduce yourself for the tape, and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. Thanks for coming to the chapter today.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Steve Mackey, the Vice President of Technology for the RCT Company in Winona, Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Hall. I am a regulatory engineer for RCT Company. I have a chemistry degree from Winona State University, and I am a certified industrial hygienist.
Mr. Mackey.
Thank you for giving us a chance to discuss this issue and our experiences with DECA. Particularly, we're going to talk about the DECA bromal diphenyl oxide. The test on the octabromal were voluntarily withdrew by industry in 2004, so they're no longer available for purchase. We're a custom compounder of engineered thermoplastics down in Winona, Minnesota. We have a 45-year history of compounding thermoplastics. We use flame retardant compounds such as DECA for one purpose only, and that's for public and consumer fire safety. We don't add DECA or anything like that to any plastics or any other reasons. 15% of our sales are from the flame retardant products, and DECA is a very significant additive for flame retardants because it's such an effective flame retardant, and it's very efficient to use. Most other alternates, you have to use considerably more flame retardant, and they're not as efficient as a flame retardant. Our experience with DECA, we've been using it for over 25 years. We use the raw form of DECA, so the raw white powder, and we handle it. Last year, corporate-wide, we used over 500,000 pounds, or 500,000 pounds of DECA. We've never had any safety or health issues related to our employees being contacted by DECA or anything like that. Our compounding process, to describe it a little bit, we add a variety of components to plastic. It might be the flame retardant, it might be glass fiber to give it strength, maybe for a switch housing, or maybe for a connector that might go inside of a television. That's where we're kind of concerned about this bill also, is because it says electronic enclosures. We don't make material for the cabinets, or compounds for the cabinets of televisions or computers, but we do make products that would be used in electrical connectors that go inside of the televisions or computers, because that's where the electronics are this high voltage 110 or 220 volt circuits that could heat up and cause a fire. So these flame retardants are in there to protect the fire. But the compounding process, we take the white powder, the DECA, and we put that through an extrusion process where we melt the plastic and we fully encapsulate the white powder into the plastic. Really, when the product is encapsulated, it's inconceivable that it can migrate out or it can be extracted out and become airborne or dust or anything like that. We are a very safety conscious company. We have a safety stewardship committee. We deal with a lot of chemicals as a compounder to put in the plastic. We want to make sure that everything that we deal with is safe. We use the DECA. The DECA has been gone through a serious study in Europe. The European Union has done a 10-year study on DECA. It involved 588 different studies. That was the study, I believe, that where industry realized that the Penta and Octa was a problem, and they voluntarily withdrew the Penta and Octa. But specifically, the European Union exempted DECA from that ruling because they felt that the risks do not overweigh the benefits of the DECA. So DECA is not banned in the European Union. Again, regarding safe alternates, again, there's no drop-in replacement for DECA, so if somebody wants, if one of the electronic manufacturers told RTP they want DECA out, we would have to come up with another alternate, and they would have to approve that, go through UL testing, which is usually anywhere from $20,000 to $100,000, depending on the type of rating they have from UL. And the other thing on alternates that we found, they are more expensive. They're usually about 1.5 to 3 times more expensive. It says that in the MPCA report. The other thing that's very well stated in the MPCA report is that the alternates, most of them have not been tested as much as DECA, so very much an alternate that could be recommended might be more harmful to the environment and humans than the DECA. So we're very concerned that someone will take a material that's gone through a lot of studies and been proven to be safe and have it alternately put in another alternate flame retardant that could be more toxic to the environment. So again, to kind of summarize, again, we're not advocating using any unsafe material. We only use the DECA to provide public safety for flame retardants. And we ask that any decisions being made on DECA, again, particularly related to DECA, I don't want to talk about Penta or Octa, are just based on the thorough and existing scientific data, which will show that DECA is safe for the humans and the environment.
Thank you.
Mr. Mackey, several members would like to ask you questions. Representative Benson? Sorry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, your company, where does it purchase DECA from? What supplier?
Mr. Mackey?
Mr. Chair, I believe we purchased DECA from a couple of sources, Tempura, the Great Lakes Chemical, and Albemarle, which is another major supplier of DECA. There's a couple of sources. I believe there are some sources from overseas also, Great Lakes Chemical. But those are the two main ones, Tempura and Albemarle.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mackey, is it your testimony then that none of these companies produce any alternatives to DECA, which you could purchase?
Mr. Mackey.
Representative, no, there is alternatives. RCT does not really make the decision on the alternative. It would be the electronic manufacturers, the Sonys, things like that. They will indicate if they do not want to use DECA, and we will comply with their wishes.
Representative Benson, follow up.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mackey, is the issue then one of cost for you or convenience for both?
Mr. Mackey.
The issue would just be complying with our customers' request for meeting certain specifications that they set for us on fire safety. And the customer pays the cost from us, so we need to meet their specifications.
President Benson, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mackey, would you be placed at a competitive disadvantage by using alternatives if some of your competitors continued to use a DECA?
Mr. Mackey.
If we could not manufacture the product in Minnesota and and our competitors could, we would probably be faced at an economic disadvantage.
Mr. Chairman, just one last one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could check the record of the testimony from the other testifiers. I thought I had heard that the European Union and the other testimony has, in fact, restricted the use of DECA. I don't know if it would be proper for us to ask one of the other testifiers to come forward. I mean, we have contradictory testimony here, at least in my mind.
Ms. Schuler, could you come forward and clarify this point for the committee, please? I think the clearest question, as I understand it, Representative Benson, catch me, is has the European Union banned the...
Already restricted
the use of DECA.
Or is it only in electronic devices?
Mr. Chair, Representative, DECA was originally to be included in the Restricting on Hazardous Substances Directive in Europe, or the ROS Directive, and it received a temporary exemption until 2010. And so, however, there is a documentation that we have that DECA is often contaminated with the lower brominated flame retardants, such as Nona and Octa. And so contaminated DECA cannot be sold in Europe because if it contains more than 0.1% of the banned chemicals. That was a temporary exemption, and it's been challenged by the European Parliament. The European Commission allowed the temporary exemption of DECA. The European Parliament has sued the Commission, and I don't believe there's an outcome from that yet.
So in summary, if I'm understanding you, there's a partial restriction on the use of DECA depending on contaminants in the DECA, with a more restrictive regulatory scheme coming on in 2010.
That's anticipated. And however, because of the fact that DECA could probably be regulated in 2010, most of the TVs sold in Europe are DECA-free, whereas they are not in the United States.
All right. Representative Hornstein, to this point?
Chairman.
Yes.
Oh.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chairman, just for anyone on the panel then, because it was mentioned that Penta and Octa are more toxic, is it true that the DECA degrades then into these more toxic elements or compounds, whatever? Is that, just for the record, is that the case?
Mr. Mackey.
Mr. Representative, the MPC Dave report kind of mentions that there has been some suggestions that could occur, but the report said there's got to be a lot more study in there because it's not conclusive that those materials degrade. I mean, they're into their lesser forms. So they said that there's, I think the report specifically says there's got to be a lot more look at that because it's not understood that that really happened.
Ms. Schuler.
Mr. Chair, my reading of the MPGA report was they very strongly supported the science behind the debromination of DECA and that it clearly debrominates to the more toxic forms. So different interpretations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Mackey, I'm sure that you did state that your employees haven't had any side effects, but what I'm looking at is the letters from the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the International Association of Firefighters who support very strongly this bill, and it isn't so much that they're saying that it's in the manufacturer there's a problem, but in the burning of the computers and TVs where the firefighters are actually fighting the fires, that these substances, the polybrominated chemicals, when they burn, they release hydrogen bromide, which is a corrosive gas and causes cancer, and it forms cancer-causing dioxin. So it's not so much in the manufacturer. And separate from the issue of the dust that would be in a home that a child could ingest or, you know, Representative Medora laying on the couch, but when these are actually burning, they're releasing these substances, and the firefighters are saying that there are other alternatives that meet the fire safety standards and are already being used by most computer companies and many television manufacturers. So why wouldn't that be of interest to you, and why would you not think of that as what it forms when it actually burns? And I'm wondering what you can say to that.
Mr. Mackey.
Yes, flame retardant chemicals, they do generate gases. That's what put out the fire, and they need the hydrogen bromide there to put out the fire. That's the mechanism. Now, the alternate flame retardants that for instance, that are recommended, one of the ones in the report is red phosphorus, and that material will release a much more toxic gas like phosphine, which we know is like a nerve gas. That should be much more of a concern for the firefighters. So, I mean, that's exactly what we're trying to portray here, is that there's no direct alternate that can be put in, and we have to make sure we base it on scientific facts. If we're going to put an alternate in, we want to make sure that that's no more harmful than the ones that are currently there.
And is that terrible chemical the only one that you could use? Because according to the firefighters, Minnesota Professional Firefighters, they're saying that there are safer alternatives that meet all the fire safety standards. Is that the only alternative that you mentioned, or are there others?
If you look at the report, there's a variety of chemicals listed there, and quite a few of them all are listed as either having certain issues or they need to be studied in further depth. The DECA is the one that's been studied the most, and we again base our information off the scientific studies. So I mean, we want to make sure that we're using one that's the most studied and has the most information available for us to make those decisions.
Mr. Mackey, on page 2, there is an exemption process allowing manufacturers to continue to use DECA from, you know, I do refer to these two bills as the ones I can't pronounce. DECA provided meeting certain criteria of working to recycling and working to eliminate or reduce the amount of DECA that you use, so on and so forth. Can you speak to the exemption process that's available in the bill?
The exemption process, I mean, we're not using any DECA for recycling purposes or anything. I mean, RCP is a manufacturer of prime products. We don't do any recycling.
Let me explain as I read it. There's an exemption process available to manufacturers in the bill, applying to the commissioner for exemption to allow you to continue to use DECA in manufacturing. There's several criteria, a description of the product, the policy statement on eliminating or reducing DECA, and then a description of the recycling and disposal system used for the product in the state, so on and so forth. So not you manufacturing for recycling, but how would these products be recycled?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Mackey.
Again, that is doable, but that would put us on an unfair playing field for our, to our competitors. If Stepno was banned, you know, we have other manufacturing sites throughout the world, I mean, and the United States. I mean, our customers will demand that we manufacture this other places. It will just take the business out of Minnesota. I mean, our customers will still want this material, and if we can't be on a fair playing field, we will move that to our other manufacturing facilities and just have a loss of economics for jobs.
Representative Fritz and then Representative Mills.
Well, to the point that, thank you, Mr. Chair, to the point that Representative Salvin was making with the firefighters, and I'm just looking at the fire chiefs, information in our packet from them, and there are, Mr. Mackey, you referenced that the manufacturer is the driving force behind why the chemical you use is used, correct?
Mr. Representative, it's our customers that specify that, the electronic manufacturers, they specify the fire safety they would like to achieve.
Mr. Chair, and I just want to draw to our attention that there are manufacturers such as Dell, Hewlett-Packard, and IKEA, who the fire chiefs are stating use safer alternative fire retardants, so that there is some progress with these huge, large companies that are already using alternative fire retardants, and I just wanted to bring that to our attention.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I forget your name, but I guess the question that you're saying that if you can't use these products, they'll be made elsewhere, but as I'm reading the bill here, it says they may not manufacture, process, or distribute in commerce, which even if somebody else makes them someplace else, you're competitive disadvantage, and I'm sensitive to that. They would be able to, your competitors would be able to sell them in the state of Minnesota either if this bill were passed. So therefore, you would all be on a level playing field there if you're selling product to be sold here. Granted, you won't be able to manufacture them here anymore, but they won't be able to manufacture them, sell them here also. So I think that kind of blows a little bit of a hole in your competitive disadvantage argument.
Mr. Mackey.
Yes, Mr. Representative. Again, customers... I guess I feel a little bit more for the other people that use DECA in the state. Like there's about 85 injection molders that mold parts made from our materials or other people's materials. And if, again, we can manufacture materials elsewhere, the electronic companies may end up pulling their business out of the state to have their materials injection molded or assembled elsewhere. I mean, this would put Minnesota at a disadvantage in terms of the electronics industry and the injection molding industry and the compounding industry.
I would like to bring this bill to a vote. We're at, you know, this is another 10-minute bill that's taken us 25 minutes at this point. We've got two more bills and testifiers who came to the Capitol to testify in favor or opposed to those bills. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. I just had one more question. This is for Representative Clark. Do you have a fiscal note for this bill?
Representative Clark.
No, there's no fiscal note. We always request a fiscal note of every single bill in my office, and we have no fiscal note.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, so you're assuming then that is it the Commissioner of Health that's going to assume the cost, because I saw that the fees are going to the Environmental Trust Fund, correct?
Representative Clark.
The Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency would be the one that would be in charge of the exemption process. That would probably be the cost that you might be talking about.
Okay, so the...
Representative Anderson.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, so the PCA is going to have to assume the cost then.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, if there are industries that want the exemption, that will be their responsibility. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Any other questions to testifiers or statements before we proceed to a vote? Seeing none, Representative Hornstein removes his motion that House File 934, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next on the agenda is House File 3533, the Chair's bill. Representative Benton.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Chairman Dabney. Thank you for the 5 minutes for a 30-minute presentation. I put that in there.
That means you've only got 5 minutes.
Would you like to move Bill 3533?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 3533. Be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. I also have a H3533A2 amendment I'd like to move to be before the committee at this time to get the bill in the form that I would prefer.
Okay, Representative Dabney moves House File 3533. Recommended for pass and referral to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And would you like to have us move H3533A2 at this point?
I so move.
All right. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of moving the amendment to the Dabney bill indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Continue, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will attempt to be uncharacteristically brief. In 1995, this legislature established a consumer small loan statute in an attempt to establish a regulatory framework for what are commonly referred to as payday loans. What we've seen, and there's documents in your packets that illustrate this, is that as this industry has grown, and it's grown significantly, and as the size of these lenders have grown, and they have grown significantly, a number of the lenders have moved from operating under our payday loan, our small consumer loan statute 4760, to instead being licensed under the industrial thrift statute 4759. This is a loophole that allows them to operate not under the intent of this legislature or the regulatory structure that this legislature established for consumer small loans, but allows them to both give larger loans than this legislature intended and charge higher interest and fees than this legislature intended. Is it legal? Yes, it is. Is it a blatant circumvention of our laws? Yes, it is. Does it violate the very spirit and intent of the law? Yes, it does. Should it be stopped in the interest of Minnesota consumers? Yes, it should. Looking nationally, the Center for Responsible Lending has established that the average number of loans that a payday borrower takes out a year is 9. That's the average. But 90% of those borrowers take out 5 or more, 60% take out 12 or more, and 24% take out 21 loans or more a year, looking nationally. The first portion of this bill simply brings all consumer small loans under the consumer small loan statute where they belong, and the second portion of the bill establishes a framework to allow these borrowers to get out of debt by establishing a installment loan mechanism for those lenders, and as an option, not a mandate, but an option for those borrowers and lenders. With me today is Mr. Ron Elwood from the Minnesota Legal Services Advocacy Project, and he can walk members through the bill.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Elwood. Would you state your name for the record and then proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'd like to thank Representative Dabney for bringing this bill forward. We're going to walk you through the bill, but before we do that, I think just a very brief background and context for this. You have in your packets something called myths and facts about payday lending. There's a lot of those out there, and I just want to dispel some of them, the myths. First of all, these are not one-time events. You will hear that that these are for one-time emergencies, and in fact, people might start out that way, but as Representative Dabney pointed out, people just don't take one. And the business model, in fact, encourages folks coming back over and over and over again and encourages repeat borrowing. These are not people who are unbanked. That is a huge myth. In fact, every single person who takes a payday loan in Minnesota has to have a checking account. You can't get a payday loan if you don't have one, because that's where the folks, the lenders will be able to, in many cases, directly take a debit right out of the person's checking account on payday. The third myth that people think is that this just happens in the inner city, in the Twin Cities here. That's not true. The fact of the matter is, over the last several years, since 1999, between 1999 and 2006, 56% of all the loans made in Minnesota were made in suburban Minnesota. Almost 30% were made in rural Minnesota, and the most small percentage was made here in the Twin Cities. So this is the folks who take these loans are between $25,000 and $50,000 workers or earners. And this is what it's aimed at. It's an exploding phenomenon. You also have in your packets a chart of the total number of loans, of the loans between 1999 and 2006. And you will see this industry has exploded. In 1999, there were 4,700 loans. In 2006, there was 187,000 of them all across the state for nearly $60 million in borrowing. Since 1999, there have been more than 1 million payday loans made in Minnesota for nearly a total of $274 million. The need to close the loophole, I think, can be illustrated by this particular handout, which compares the APRs, the annual percentage rates, under the Consumer Small Loan Act and the loophole, the Section 4759. If you'll notice, for example, a $100 loan under the payday loan, the Small Loan Act, is translates to a 390% APR. For the very same transaction, exactly the same transaction under 4759, the APR is 685%. Under 4759, the lenders are able to charge five times more in fees than they can under 4760. They're able to extract an additional $50 annual fee if they structure the transaction as an open-end line of credit. And the bottom line is, for the extra money, there is zero additional benefit to the borrower. The borrower gets nothing in addition for paying almost twice as much in the $100 case. The second part of the bill, providing for an option to repay the loans over in installments, I would draw your attention to the Newsweek article that is in your packet that talks about people getting caught in the debt trap. And with that, I guess if you want to walk through the bill, we'd like to bring Professor Cox and Professor Taft up as well.
Any questions for Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, joining me is Professor Prentice Cox from the University of Minnesota Law School and one of the students from his clinics program who is involved in the development of this legislation.
Welcome to the committee. If you would state your names for the record, please. Proceed.
Thank you. Prentice Cox.
Dan Hoyt Pass.
And proceed.
Proceed with walking through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll very briefly talk about how we're going to bring all the loans that were intended to be regulated into the 4760 Consumer Small Loan Act, and this staff will talk about the consumer protections that have been added to the bill. The scope provision has been changed to bring into the regulation of 4760 all loans that are $600 or less for personal, family, or household purposes that also require a minimum payment of 15% on any initial, on any periodic payment. That does two things. One is it takes lenders who are currently licensed as industrial loans and thrifts or would be otherwise licensed as a regulated entity, allowing them to lend under 4759, and requires that, the bill then requires that, if they're a consumer small loan lender, that they lend under this chapter rather than 4759. The second thing it does is it takes products that have been designed, where the product itself is designed, for instance, as an open-end credit loan, so it doesn't appear to fall under the existing definition of a payday loan, and it brings it within this chapter. So whether the circumvention occurs because it's the nature of the way the product structures or because of the regulatory structure of the company that's making it, it eliminates both of those methods of circumventing and brings it within the protections of 4760.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, as Mr. Elwood and Professor Cox mentioned, my name is Ann Hoyt-Pass, and I am a member of the Consumer Protection Clinic at the University of Minnesota Law School. We've been working on provisions of this bill, and I'm going to discuss briefly three of the borrower protections that are inserted in the bill, including the contract requirements in Section 7, the private right of action in Section 8, and the collection action regulations in Section 9 through 12. To begin, under the current law in Subdivision 4, the lender is only required to provide a borrower with a copy of the contract if the borrower so requests. And the problem with that transaction is that unless a borrower requests, a borrower doesn't really have any understanding of its obligations or rights under the transaction. The bill provides a mandatory contract provision, which gives the borrower a right to a mandatory contract written in the language in which the contract was negotiated. The borrower is also able to request a copy of the contract written in the language that any language that the lender is advertising in. Some of the provisions in this contract requirement include minimum protections such as...
Excuse me one moment. We do have a question. Representative Peterson.
Could, when you talk about sections, could you refer me to a page of the bill? I'm trying to track it with you, and I'm having trouble turning pages and picking it up with you. They were saying Section 4, which is on page 2, I believe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are currently talking about Section 7 of the bill. I was referring to Subdivision 4 because in the old law, in the current law, 4760 of Subdivision 4, currently we're talking about Section 7, which is on
bottom
page.
Page 6. Mr. Chair, Section 7 begins on page 6, line 29.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Some of the contract requirements include minimal information about the lender, such as phone number, address, and then information about the loan itself, including itemization of fees, interest, APR, and a clear description of the borrower's payment obligations, as well as a right to enter into a payment plan, which Mr. Elwood will be discussing in a moment. The purpose of this mandatory contract requirement is to inform borrowers of their obligation and their rights under the transaction they entered into. The next section of the bill is Section 8, Subdivision 6, which is on page 7, line 18. Thank you. Under the current law, there is a private right of action. The borrower is harmed by a violation of the law's provisions can only obtain $100 in damages. Such a low fee provides no incentive for a borrower actually to take a claim to court, even to small claims court, because the reward would be so minimal in comparison to the cost of bringing an actual claim. The bill under Section 8 on page 7 allows a borrower to bring a claim for a violation of the substantive provisions of the law, for example, exceeding interest rates or charging excessive fees. As what you're entitled to if you bring this right of action and it is found that there was a violation is a refund on all of the fees paid on the loan, as well as $1,000 in statutory damages for any violation. There is a savings clause under the statutory damages provision, which provides that there will not be statutory damages for mistakes that the lender can prove were unintentional and clerical errors. And the purpose of this provision is it will really actually provide an enforcement mechanism for the provisions in this bill. $1,000 in statutory damages makes it worth the while of a borrower to go to court and file claims against violations of the law. And it would also supplement any administrative enforcement because borrowers on their own would be able to enforce the provisions and hopefully serve as a deterrent to other lenders. The final section of the bill is the collection action bill.
Just that.
Yes.
The collection action, remember, Mr. Chair, collection actions portion is Section 9. It begins at the very bottom of page 7, but the changes, the proposed changes run along page 8. Thank you,
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Sections 9 through 12 concern collection actions. Currently, if a payday lender is collecting on a loan made by their own organization, there are no laws which bring their behavior into under certain regulations of Minnesota law. So by amending Chapter 332, which is the Collection and Credit Services Chapter, we can bring payday loan lenders who are collecting, again, on loans made by their own company within the protections provided to borrowers from credit services and collection agencies, for example. These protections would include prohibiting the use or threats of collection methods which would in general violate Minnesota law, threatening borrowers with legal action when no such legal action has been taken, would enforce all the provisions of the FDCPA, and would forbid collecting money from borrowers that is not authorized, as well as requiring lenders to do simple things like give receipts for payments made. And in this law, payday lenders will not be subject to the licensing requirements that other collection agencies are. There is an exemption from that provision, but they are subject to all the borrower protections contained in Chapter 332.
Thank you, Ms. Depp. Any questions now from the committee for Mr. Cox or Ms. Tapp before we move on? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We have, Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and members, Ron Elwood again, Legal Aid. Just to complete the walkthrough of the bill, the highlights here, I draw your attention to page 2, lines 25, where the loan limit under Section 4760 for a payday loan, we raise the limit from the current $350 up to $600. $350 was installed in 1995, and we thought that in moving folks, you know, the cows are out of the barn and we're trying to move them back into the barn, and we figured after 13 years it's probably fair to increase the cap. I would note that if you take 3% inflation, it is even greater than the inflation at that rate. So we thought that was a reasonable limit. On page 4, line 14, section 5, is the other real centerpiece of the bill, which is providing the ability of consumers to repay in installments. We, under this bill, it would provide an option to repay in 5 installments of 20% of the principal each, and requiring clear notice to the borrower of that option. The real problem with these payday loans is that whether or not you think they should be here, whether you think they're good or bad, whether you think people need them or not, the bottom line is it's kind of like the old Eagles song, from the Hotel California. You know, you can check out, but you can never leave because you continue to take these one after the other. Even if you really came in and really wanted it one time, the way these things are structured, you're borrowing against your next paycheck. And when you come in to try to pay off the old loan, well, what are you going to do for the next 2 weeks? And as, again, Representative Dabney pointed out, the average number of loans is fairly high. So this section is directed precisely at keeping people out of the debt trap. And finally, just to mention on page 5, line 19, Section 6 of the bill adds some additional reporting requirements that the lenders would have to provide to the Department of Commerce for more information. They already provide a report. This would give us more data to really look at and keep track of the industry. Happy to answer questions. Oh, one more thing, excuse me. I just want to mention that the groups that are supporting this bill include the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, the Minnesota AFL-CIO, Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, Jewish Community Action, and the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. You have letters from some of them. I have some letters here that didn't get to your packets in time, but those are the groups that are supporting Representative Dabney's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Elwood, on page 7, looks like line 28 with the penalty against the lender. If I were to borrow from a lender and found that they made an error and I used this part of the bill, I see that the lender has the burden of proving that an error was not intentional. But let's say the lender proves that it's a was not intentional and it was a legitimate error. Is there any payment back to the lender for the cost that it took the lender to have an attorney go through this and protect themselves, or is this just a one-way street?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howes, no, there wouldn't be any payment back to the lender.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Elwood, then it is conceivable that a borrower could at any time for any reason claim there were intentional errors as many times as they wanted to because there is no cost to them to do that, and they might get lucky and get $1,000?
Mr. Elwood. Representative Dabney.
Representative House, you're correct that there is no reimbursement of any possible attorney fees or court costs to the lender if they are able to prove that there is this was an honest clerical error. There is also, you'll note, no reimbursement of attorney fees or court costs for the borrower if they proceed with the action.
Representative Hall.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, pardon me, but aren't we kind of, to me, we're hanging a carrot out there. You've got this shot of getting $1,000 if you can prove that there was an error in the transaction that was unintentional.
Mr. Elwood.
Intentional.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howes, I think this actually was something that we put in because we thought it was fair to prevent exactly the kind of thing that you're trying to prevent, and I'll explain why. In order for an action to be taken and an attorney to take the case, I mean, you know, attorneys are have ethical obligations to not to bring frivolous claims. And so if there is, in fact, if there was smoke and there's a potential fire, that would be the only time any attorney would proceed with the case. Now, they may not be able to prove their case. That may be true. However, attorneys are just not going to throw, you know, the clients to the wolves in these cases. It's just not something that people do. And I think, especially with this particular provision there, this would put a chilling effect on any attorney trying to take an action where there's very slim evidence that this was an intentional violation. So I think this actually was put in here to counterbalance the increase in the damages, the statutory damages, to provide the fairness to if there was a mistake, a legitimate mistake, that a case would not be brought unless there was a good evidence that it was intentional.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, he explained it well, but that wouldn't prevent me, a non-attorney, from, if I did a payday loan, to bring forward a case and try to capture that $1,000. And how many people like me are out there that would be nuisances and just keep going after that, trying to get it, and what's it going to cost? Is it going to drive the lender away from making loans?
Before Mr. Cox will answer that question, I just want to remind the committee that we've now used 23 minutes of our 30 minutes, and so we need to move along. Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know you or know how much of a nuisance you see, but I can tell you.
I can answer that question.
The chair did not recognize Representative Dabney that answer.
But that doesn't answer your question. There's a disincentive to bringing the kind of lawsuit you're suggesting because, first of all, the filing fees, as a result of changes in the budget a couple of years ago, are really quite high. It costs $350. It costs $350 just to get into court.
Okay.
So you would not do that if your chances of prevailing were not great, as well as the fact that there are additional fees and costs in bringing such a lawsuit.
Thank you.
Any other questions in committee? Representative Dabney, do you? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Interestingly enough, last night on public radio, 8 o'clock drive time, there was a program probably being broadcast about this very topic, and they were referring to two reports. One of the reports was the Federal Reserve Bank report of New York, and I think even when the testifier said this had some information in it that was possibly questionable. But there was a second report. In that report, in both cases, the testifying was that these do play a role, and that in those states, in those situations where they have outlawed them or have made the interest rate so low that they are no longer profitable for the risk involved, that those states, there's been a real loss. And although it's very easy to villainize this type of lending, there is a real need for it because there is no other safety net for some people. Now, so I'm making that statement, and I'll get some reaction because I've gone through now the Federal Reserve report from New York, and I think that has supported my, although I'm an author on this bill, it supports my belief that there is a need for this. It does play a role, and I do embrace the idea of putting under Section 47 Small Loan Act. I just want to make sure that we're not trying to close this door on these types of things that will drive it out of the state of Minnesota and we will be disadvantaged and hurt somehow by it. And I need somebody to confirm to me that that's not what we're doing. And then I'm going to do a follow-up question that says, is there a horse and saddle going on here, because the next bill we're going to listen to starts talking about changing the usury rates, and are these yoked? Is one of them a horse and the other one's a saddle, and at the end of the day we're going to walk out of here having hurt this process?
Mr. Bellwood or Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, first of all, another myth, these are not risky loans. The default rate between 1999 and 2006 for the million loans that have been made is 1.5%. So that's an incredibly low default rate. That's number one. Number two, the Federal Reserve report to which you refer has been widely discredited. It was written by a person who arguably was very biased, has been a quarter of the payday lending industry for a long time. Even his Federal Reserve colleagues have criticized his report of the methodology he used. For example, he suggested that North Carolina and Georgia, where the loans were banned, bad check rates increased. Well, the method, what he used was the regional check processing center, which sweeps in many, many, many states, not just North Carolina and Georgia. So I'm not sure we would rely on that for any kind of reliable and credible information.
Except that he was, the report is positive of maintaining the industry.
Still.
And against banning it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, that is his conclusion. Mm-hmm. And this bill does not ban it. It simply puts people back under the law that was designed to govern this kind of transaction. And as you note, this bill does not change the rate structure. It simply adds another tier to address going from 350 to 600. The next bill, I mean, the fact of the matter is that there have been 13 states that have banned this stuff, and there, as North Carolina Banking Commissioner did a study about the effect of what happens in that state when the payday lenders left. And the conclusions, these were from borrowers, and the conclusions were, A, people thought it was a bad thing. B, they felt they were better off without it. C, they were able to find that credit elsewhere. And I would point out to you that, you know, payday lending did not exist before the early 1990s. And somehow Americans for 220 years figured out how to meet their short-term cash needs without this product. But this bill does not ban the product. It simply makes people follow the law.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Unless there are other questions from the committee, I would like to move on. And Representative Dabney, if you have another testifier, why don't we bring that person forward? We now have 5 minutes left of our... We have 2 minutes left of our half hour.
Mr. Chair, this actually is a good segue. Representative Peterson laid the groundwork. In your packet should be a copy of an article from Sunday Star Tribune talking about the credit union, or several credit unions in the state, providing similar services under a different regulatory framework that meets the needs of the borrowers without the interest rate and fee structure that we're finding under the industrial loan and thrift statute.
Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name and identify yourself for the record, please?
So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Swallen, and I am the president of Highway Federal Credit Union in St. Paul. I'm here today in support of Representative Dabney's bill, which would put payday lenders back under the consumer small loan statute and allows them the ability to repay their loans through an installment plan. Credit unions strive to serve their members in the best way possible as they help them make financial decisions that best impact their future. As part of this long-term relationship, credit unions have no interest in placing their members into a seemingly never-ending cycle of loans and astronomical interest rates and list of fees that prevents the principal from ever being paid off. Statistics show that 1 in 5 credit union members are payday loan users. Much as Highway did not offer subprime loans, we believe at Highway that payday loans at the existing rates and fees are not good for our members and do not offer them. One thing that credit unions view as very important is financial education and financial literacy. Looking out for the long-term financial health of our members is critical to our mission, and we work to help educate members make sound financial decisions. I believe that this bill helps to provide effective consumer protections for those who take out a payday loan. In the interest of time, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swallen. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have one more testifier from Minnesota Bankers Association.
Ms. Wright. Welcome to the committee, and will you state your name and identify yourself, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association.
Proceed, ma'am.
We're here to support the A2 amendment to the bill, which included savings banks among the institutions that are exempt from the definition of consumer small lending.
Okay. Thank you. That was very succinct. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Peterson.
In this bill, I'm a client. I'm required to have a checking account because I'm going to give you a post-dated check. Do I incriminate myself when that check bounces?
That's right.
Or are you going to use your collection agency of Leroy to come get me and break my arm? That's the concern always been, that you have to do a post-dated check. The check bounces. The client now pays the $45, and now the bankers charge him another $30. And kick them out, and if they get kicked out and therefore the check is a non-sufficient fund, has that borrower now subjected themselves to some kind of legal action because they've given a bad check? Again, those are horse and saddle. How are they tied together so the committee understands?
Ms. Rice, this time.
Well, I'm not an expert on the payday lending industry. I can tell you that any check that someone writes from their bank account certainly will be subject to an overdraft fee.
Mr. Chair, this very issue is addressed in the legislation. I'd ask Professor Cox to come forward. I think he may be a better person to answer your question.
Professor Cox?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, we didn't draft this part of the bill, but I will respond to it and note that Counsel Tom Fender, who I've worked with when I was at the AG's office for many years and does a wonderful job, pointed out some problems with this section of the bill that probably need to be fixed going forward. But there is a section of the criminal statute regarding dishonored checks, 609.533. That says a post-dated check is not part of that statute, so you cannot prosecute for dishonoring a postdated check, but the bill also includes, to clarify that, the bill also includes a section saying that prosecution is not possible in relation to a transaction under the Consumer Small Loan Act. So the answer to your question is no. You cannot prosecute someone for a dishonoring check. The bill also, by the way, it does provide a protection that we wrote in saying that it is improper, illegal under the Consumer Small Loan Act to threaten criminal prosecution of a borrower under the Act.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Peterson, as Professor Cox has indicated, Mr. Pender has raised some concerns about, I think, clarity of language in this provision, and the intent is if this bill proceeds to commerce and then proceeds from there to public safety, that is the most appropriate venue to address those specific concerns. And the intent of the author would be to then...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing to default on the loan, but you hate to create a twofer. Not only have I defaulted on the loan, but now I've got an action because of that check. And that's when you really beat them up.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Dabney, any comments at this point we call those who wish to speak in opposition?
No, let's give the opponents their opportunity.
All right. Is Remy Stone present? Welcome to the committee. If you will state your name and identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senior Mailcat, I've got one of those voices that's been going around up here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Remy Stone. I'm an attorney and an employee of Advance America. Advance America is the nation's largest payday lender. We operate in 35 states across the nation, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Interestingly enough, we do not operate in the state of Minnesota yet, but we do conduct business in every single surrounding state, surrounding the state of Minnesota. Quite frankly, the payday lending statute in Minnesota does not support a monoline company like mine. You're probably asking what a monoline company is. We're a company that carries our risk solely on a single product, payday cash advances. We do not spread our risk around on check cashing, title lending, internet lending, signature loans, nothing like that. Your existing statute does not work for a regulated storefront like mine to operate in here. Even with Representative Daphne's bill, you will still find that regulated companies like mine will not be able to provide a regulated safe product in the state. Members, and I'll go through this since we've spent a lot of time on payday and other things today. I'm abbreviating my comments. You have before you a draft proposal that my company and our trade association, CFSA, has prepared. Unfortunately, it's stuck in the revisor's office like everything else this session. And so it's not been jacketed and introduced yet, but we would certainly appreciate the ability to come back here and talk with you about what our proposal does as well. You've also got a matrix in your packet and a summary of the current payday statute in Minnesota. I need to draw your attention to the fact that indeed in Minnesota, you do have a zero rollover opportunity, so you do have that as consumer protection on payday lending, but you also have a limitation that a person may have one loan, one payday advance at a time. And just quickly, on our proposal, and then I'm going to get into the specifics of Representative Daphne's bill, just be aware, Representative Peterson, you talked about whether there's criminal prosecution. Criminal prosecution is a best practice that my company and our industry has adopted for years. We do not pursue criminal prosecution for people who bounce bad checks. It's a best practice that we do not do. mandatory extended payment plan. Mr. Elwood and Legal Aid have incorporated into Representative Dabney's bill a mandatory extended payment plan. We're very flattered and actually thank them for generating that conversation, because that too is a best practice that the industry has supported and urged for many years. The reason why is that we too believe that this product is a short-term product not intended for long-term use. In our bill, and this is why payday lending does not work for a monoline company.
I don't want to interrupt, but because of the time pressure, if you would just maybe keep your remarks to this particular bill,
sure.
And then hopefully we will have an opportunity to see your bill in the future.
Okay. Well, those last two pieces were also part of Representative Dabney's bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
This last piece is also part of Representative Dabney's bill, and it relates to uniform rates. Representative Dabney, we subscribe to $15 per $100 lent. That's consistent with current statute in Minnesota for the first $100 lent. Unfortunately, the rate structure is tiered in Minnesota, and even though Representative Dabney's bill increases the rate to the loan amount to $600, you still have a tiered step-down rate. For those of you who appreciate risk, this rate structure and the fact that the loan is increased gives you a false sense of compromise. The irony here is that the greater the risk, i.e. the larger the advance, the lower the rate of return. It makes no business sense to do that. And that's on pages 2 through 3. Page 4.1, you'll see a 21-day cooling-off period. Cooling-off periods aren't unheard of. 21-day period cooling-off period is unheard of. What that essentially says is somebody needs to be out of the product for 21 days before they take another advance. Let's just make this simple and say that if you're a person who gets paid once every 2 weeks, you're entitled to have a cash advance 10 times a year. If you're a person who gets paid once a month, you're entitled to have a cash advance 7 times a year. Not only does it smack of equity issues, but how often have we told people how many times they can bounce a check, transact credit card charges, or for that matter, have financial emergencies per year? Mr. Chairman, we talked briefly about the extended payment plan. The fact of the matter is that we support the idea of a payment plan. The disclosure language that's in this bill, I would encourage you to read carefully because, quite frankly, it's a little inflammatory. While we talk about how much it costs to take out a cash advance, it couches it in very high terms and does not actually talk about the fact that it's a $15 fee per 100. So not only are we not doing full disclosure, but now we're full disclosing without the full facts. I do want to let you know that we do believe in full disclosure. It's true. $15 on $100 is 391%. $34 credit union overdraft on a $4.07 Starbucks charge is 27,000 APR. I know that one for a fact. I did it 3 weeks ago. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, contracting Minnesota's law doesn't really leave us with very many options. We send people online, which is essentially offshore to offshore internet lenders, across the border to Wisconsin, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, or we send them underground. This statute was created to provide Minnesotans the ability to have a safe, regulated, short-term, unsecured credit option. This bill contracts the ability to provide that option and does not allow companies like mine to come into this state. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Storm, possibly you should have gone to Wisconsin to protect yourself from that overdraft.
Yeah, it's a great irony, isn't it, that I work for a payday lending company and I can't access it in Minnesota. You're right.
Any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Stone? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is Paul Cassidy here? I believe you have a couple people. Again, Mr. Cassidy, we were running well over time. Percentage-wise, though, I'm still doing better than we were doing in the first two bills there. But
that wouldn't be difficult.
Would you give your name for the record and identify yourself, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street & Diner in Minneapolis. I'm here today with our client, Brad Richman, who is the CEO of Payday America, which has a number of outlets in the state of Minnesota and is based in Minnesota. I will keep my my comments brief and hand it off to Mr. Richman to get into a little bit more detail and skip some of the details that Ms. Stone has already covered for us. But as you listen to the testimony today from both sides, I hope you'll keep a couple of things in mind. First of all, that the customers, and some of whom are here today, turned to us because they really don't have any other alternative. Don't drive these customers to the internet or to our border states or underground where they used to go before the law was put in place in the mid-90s. Second, Minnesota law allows for varying levels of lending. As members of the Commerce Committee, you're going to see various bills come through this committee over the years that will address different levels of lending that we have on the books in Minnesota statutes. This is just one more tool that's allowed by Minnesota law to assist our customers and our consumers that have no other alternative. It keeps the transaction above board and protects consumers who might otherwise have no other alternative. Finally, I leave you with one final thought. The types of loans you're addressing today are done on a signature and a handshake. They're not large, long-term loans. Discussions of high annual interest rates are simply discussions of red herrings. These are short-term transactions, so let me leave you with one thought, and that is to ask yourself this question when you're listening to the testimony. Do you believe it's fair and reasonable to loan a complete stranger $100 for 2 weeks, secured only by a promise and a handshake, in hopes that the person will return 2 weeks later and pay you $101.50? Do you answer yes to that? Then you believe that $1.50 is a fair return on your investment. Mr. Chairman and members, I hope my remarks are short. I'll hand it off to Mr. Richman from Payday America, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Mr. Richman, welcome to the committee. If you state your name and identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brad Richman. I and my family own Payday America. I am a Minnesota resident. I was born, raised, and educated here. I own Payday America, which is the leading provider of secured and unsecured consumer loans to Minnesotans. We have made loans to over 30,000 Minnesotans since our company began business in 2000. We are an industrial loan and thrift company licensed under Chapter 53 of Minnesota statutes, and we make consumer loans under Minnesota Statute 4759. We offer a one-year line of credit to our customers. We operate 13 loan offices in Minnesota. We employ over 50 Minnesota residents and serve, or last year we wrote 120,000 loans. I'm here to ask you today to vote against House File 3533 because if it is passed in the law, frankly, my company is out of business and I will not be able to make loans to consumers who use our services. It will completely eliminate our ability to make drug-regulated loans and force Minnesotans who need access to short-term credit to drive across the border, as was mentioned before. Customers will be forced to obtain loans on the internet, which is largely unregulated, and again, will cost Minnesota consumers significantly higher fees and turn to illegal and unregulated sources of ready cash. To qualify, all a customer needs is two paychecks, some banking information, a driver's license, and social security card. So the process is very quick and easy, and that is why consumers turn to us. Payday America operates as an industrial loan and thrift company and not as a consumer small loan lender, quite simply because it offers us and our customers greater flexibility in terms of the types of loan products that can be offered. Payday America offers a longer-term loan, higher loan amounts. We make loans from $50 to $1,000 to our customers as an open-ended credit, and we also offer secured lending. These types of loans are not available under consumer small loans. The average loan for our company is between $350 to $400.
In exchange for this greater flexibility, Payday America is subject to greater oversight by the Minnesota Department of Commerce and regulatory requirements. For example, we are structured as a Minnesota corporation. We meet higher capitalization requirements, and we must maintain reserve balances. And we have increased reporting requirements that consumer small lenders do not have. Payday America provides convenient, cost-effective short-term credit options to Minnesota consumers. We fill a niche not met by banks or credit unions. These loans cover small, unexpected, unplanned expenses that come from time to time, such as car repairs. They avoid more costly bounce check fees or late payment penalties. They solve temporary cash flow problems without having to ask family members for money. Payday America customers are middle-income Minnesotans. The majority earn between $25,000 and $50,000. They're well-educated. 94% have high school diplomas or better, and 56% have some college or an advanced degree. A young family, 68% are under 45 years of age, and a majority are married, and 64% have children in their household. They're from stable, working-class families. 42% own homes. 100% have steady income and checking accounts. Bank NSF default interest and lender charges on mortgage loans and merchant fees on a bounce check are more than double than the cost of a $100 consumer loan. If held to the same standard, many financial alternatives would have comparable, if not higher, annual percentage rates. But the central focus by academics on the issue of APRs is really a red herring in this debate. Although Payday America believes that APRs must be disclosed, disproportionate attention to APRs is misleading on very short-term, small-dollar amount transactions. For example, a $100 loan with a $15 fee is the equivalent of a 391% APR. A $100 check with a $26.90 overdraft protection fee is 701% as an APR. A $100 credit card balance with a $37 late fee equals 965% as an APR. A $100 utility bill with a $46.16 late and reconnect fee is the equivalent of 1,200% as an APR. And a $100 check with a $30 NSF fee is 782% as an APR. House File 3533 seeks to reduce the fees to 36% in annual percentage rate, which at first blush may seem reasonable. However, given the short term of the loan, the small dollar amount, and the high cost of the alternative, a strict APR analysis is simply misleading. On a $100 loan for 2 weeks, the 36% APR yields approximately $1.50 in fees to Payday America. This is on a loan that is secured by only a post-dated check or a pre-authorized draft. Consumer small loans are permitted in 38 states. All of these other states, including our neighbors in Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa, the internet banks and credit unions charge significantly higher fees and interest. Minnesota has by far the lowest fees and interest in the country. Overall, Payday America's customers are very satisfied with the products and the services that we provide. Our customers have a very low default rate, less than 2% go to collection, and we receive very few consumer complaints. The few number of defaults and complaints indicates that the current legislative and regulatory system is working.
Mr. Rickman, and everyone has had a lot of time, but we are running very short. If you could just summarize real quickly, please.
Yes, sir. Well, in the interest of time, we do have a number of customers that would like to testify as well. So,
can you narrow it down to one?
Yes, I'll stand.
Thank you, Mr. Rickson. Mr. Kathy?
Mr. Chairman, members, we have a couple of customers that might make a few comments. They take the time out of the day to come down here. And
all right.
A couple of minutes from there. Thank you.
Please come down. Welcome to the committee, and hopefully we can have a real brief presentation. So welcome to committee. If you state your name for the record and identify yourself, please, and then proceed.
Sure. My name is Randy Fowler, and I'm a Payday America consumer. And all I'd like to say is that they were great. I mean, they the 1 week that I had rent due, my car broke down, and I worked 26 miles from work. So just to get the loan, you know, to pay for the gas and to pay, you know, get the car repaired was an excellent thing. And right now I am, you know, with the loan, I am not one that's going to continue on with it. I'm going to use it in a sense of an emergency, such as what I did there, you know, about 2 months ago. And now I'm back on my feet, and I would like to say that I owe it to Payday America because, you know, they were able to give me the money to get my car fixed so I could get to work and continually make paychecks, because the job that I was at was pretty, they were very stringent on their absenteeism, you know, and calling in sick and stuff like that. So I had to be there, you know, at that job. So I really thank Payday America. They're great. I really like them.
Thank you.
So that's it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Scalzi, I can bring witness back. Would you come on back to the microphone for a moment? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You really escaped faster. I was going to ask you, and that's a compelling story, and you know, everyone has circumstances. I was going to ask you if you had thought at the time of maybe going to a credit union where you would have had a lower interest rate. Have you checked that out at all?
Yeah, I did.
Mr. Fowler.
Oh, sorry. And my credit is not very good right now, so there was no way. I actually did try for a loan on the car, and, you know, it didn't work.
Okay.
There was no way.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you state your name and identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Janice Cromwell, and I live in Maplewood in a mobile home. This is hard for me because I'm not used to talking in front of people, but...
We're just regular people here, yeah. So don't worry about it.
I'm a single parent that took care of my mother. I'm sorry, today would have been her 88th birthday. She died 4 months ago. And the three of us worked together in the home. And my mother, she had a small social security because we lived in Indiana with a smaller pay. But it took $600 of her $700. To help pay for our living expenses here, and I was working two jobs and barely making ends meet. When she passed away 4 months ago, it put the burden on me. I have a 19-year-old daughter that's been looking for work since she graduated June 1st last year and has put in 120 applications in the last 4 months and still has not found a job. I pay two car payments. I pay a mortgage payment, I pay lot rent, I pay insurance on two cars and a house. I'm working two jobs and I still can't make ends meet. I just had one of the car places put three loan payments at the end of my loan 2 days ago. They did that for me. I owe two mortgage payments, which is about $500 total. I was in dire straits. I was afraid my family, my daughter and I would be out on the street. I went to two different banks, which I bank at as two banks, both less than $10 in each one, and neither one of them would give me a loan. So I worked for Metro Transit. I went to the credit union at Metro Transit. You have to have an account with them before they would give you a loan, and I could not get one there. My neighbor told me about Payday America, and I went there. And I'm not on the street right now because of them. And they have helped me so much in the last 4 months. It's not an every 2 week thing that's going to put me in debt. I took out a $500 loan and my payback after 2 weeks is $532. So it cost me $32 to keep my daughter and myself in a home instead of out on a street corner somewhere begging. And I thank them. If it wasn't for them, that's where we would be. I start a third job next month, and I will be working three jobs to make ends meet to try to catch up. But until that happens, when the twins start on the 31st of March, I will have a third job. And I will work my tail off like I have the last 15. When my dad died, my mom moved in with me, and I've taken care of all three of us. And I can't do it right now. But I thank Payday America, because without them, I'd be on the street right now instead of sitting here in front of you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonner. Any questions from the committee? Any other persons wishing to speak for or against this particular bill? And we have to move on. We're quite late.
Good afternoon.
My name Would you identify yourself and give us your name and identify yourself to the committee?
Kirk Williams. I'm from Mendota Heights, Minnesota. I'm born and raised in Minnesota and thankful for that. Just to be quick with time, I have two grandchildren and have raised a family here in Minnesota, which would give an indication that I'm about half a century old. So I've been through the ups and downs of raising a family. I think the thing that makes the short-term loan opportunity a good one, particularly I've done business with the unloaned company, is just the short, quick emergency help that families need. I know that I needed it for my family, particularly I'm a salesman. We go through what I would call feast and famine cycles in my field. When I'm in a famine situation and I need fuel, and particularly medication because I have high blood pressure, I've used the short-term loans for that. As we all know, having high blood pressure and not having medication immediately, we know that a stroke is very unforgiving. So I'm for it, and I would use it in an instant again if need be. That is for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
You're welcome.
I think I have one more. Oh, okay.
Welcome to the committee. I'm appreciative of the chair's adherence to time, but if we've got members of the public who can,
yes,
I do feel
right.
I'll give them the opportunity.
Thank you to the committee. If you will state your name and identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
My name is Stuart Tapper. I'm here today representing Unloan. I'm vice president of Unloan. We operate eight industrial loan and thrifts in the state of Minnesota, as well as I'm also president of the Minnesota Financial Service Center, where we represent over 40 licensed industrial loan and thrifts, as well as we represent small lenders operating under 4760. And I'm here to tell you today that I'm opposed to this proposed legislation, and if it does go through, it would force us to stop offering that product. I'm not going to reiterate all the other comments that have been brought up by some of the other people that have been spoken against it, but I am simply here to tell you that, you know, we've done over, I think we did about 1,000 loans last, 10,000 loans last year, and we, as a result of our operations, we employed an additional 30 Minnesotans that, unfortunately, we would, if this product went away, we would be forced to terminate or to do other things with. And given, and the representative that brought up that the report from the New York Federal Exchange, I would tell you to, I would encourage you all to study it if you don't, and if not, I'll be happy to provide you with copies of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tapper. Any questions from the committee?
No.
Representative
Pearson. We keep talking about the interest rate. There still has a couple other items in it, the payment plans and something else. Those are not the issue. It's the rate.
It is the rate.
Mr. Tapper.
Sorry. The rate is the issue. In terms of the payment plan, we do that ourselves. If a customer comes to us and says, you know what, we can't pay it, can we pay it in two or three installments, we're happy to work with them. It is as much in our best interest to get the loan paid as it is for the customer to get the product and to get the money. We don't want to go through collection processes. We don't want to spend the money. We don't want to spend the time. So
provided, and what we do, we call the customer the day before. We talk to them. If there's a problem, we will have them come in. We will talk to them, and we will set up our own payment plan.
Representative Peterson. Thank you, Mr. Tapper.
Thank you very much.
Mr.
Chair.
I do have a question for the author, if I may.
All right.
Mr. Dabney, and again, I'm on this bill, but my concern is I am absolutely convinced that the melodahess that we are in the mortgage industry and the predatory lending in mortgages was caused by the Internet. Even again this morning, I was on the treadmill and I'm watching Come Get Your Mortgage through something on the Internet. And it was that kind of a vehicle that pushed people into doing mortgages in the predatory type, because it was so easy and it was so quick and they could do it all in the confines of their basement. And in those situations where the bad mortgage was with a local bank or a credit union, there was an opportunity to work through those and work out of that. But when that thing goes into cyberspace, it creates a whole other element of abuse that is really bad. We're seeing the fallback of that now. If we, in fact, are well-intentioned to protect and see the thing that we've got some predatory thing going on here and that we want to protect somebody, we may, in fact, be doing just the opposite. We may be pushing them into the Internet that is our well-intentioned legislation, in fact, creates a Gila monster. And I'm sitting here sensing that is going to happen. We're well-intended, and the legal aid is well-intended, but are we really sure we want to do this? Because undoing it will be too late.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, thank you for the question. I directed the lines 2.20 to 2.23. This bill applies to internet lenders as well as lenders domiciled in the state. So the very concern that you are raising correctly is already addressed in the bill as written.
Representative Peterson.
We can control that, Chief.
Representative Dabney.
If you are making consumer small loans in the state of Minnesota, this statute applies. So the statute of broad applicability to those in that industry.
Representative Peterson.
I don't think that was true in the mortgage lending. I don't think it was true, and I know it's another section of code, but we're able to subscribe some kind of legislation that does for this small loan industry that we couldn't do for the outer space for mortgage lending, which was a lot more restricted over the past, or am I smoking something?
Isn't that me?
Professor Cox can tell us.
Not after last year's smoking ban, no. We are in the deep end of the pool here. I will put forward my best guess, and then Professor Cox will slap me upside the head if I'm wrong. But the challenge with the predatory lending issue of last year was we did not regulate lenders who are regulated elsewhere, the federal preemption. And that prohibited us, and in fact, there were further Supreme Court decisions during U.S. Supreme Court decisions during last legislative session that pushed us further away from being able to regulate affiliates and subsidiaries of nationally chartered banks and credit unions. That is not the case in this situation. If I'm wrong,
Professor
Cox will cover me.
Professor Cox, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it's easy to cover Representative Dabney because he's so smart, and he's right on this one. It was not internet lending, and I actually really know what I'm talking about. We'll talk about I'm supposedly an expert on it. It was not internet lending that pushed us into the subprime mortgage crisis. These were subprime lenders locally. There is a difference between federal and state regulation. There's a separate issue about whether we can regulate on internet. If that's your concern, this bill goes a long way to addressing that. Currently, the bill applies to registered and licensed entities with the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce has taken the position, which, frankly, I strongly disagree with. I don't think there's anything in that bill, if you read it, that says that if a loan is made, a payday loan is made in Minnesota by a Wisconsin company or an internet company, that it is not regulated under 4760, but that's their position for whatever reason. What this bill does is keeps the registration and licensing in the Department of Commerce the same, so they can take that position as registration and licensing. But as to all other consumer protections and regulation of rates in the bill, it provides a private right of action and brings the internet and out-of-state lenders who make loans in Minnesota under our protections in 4760. So it actually, part of what we're doing is extending that protection out.
My intellect is being overridden by my emotion on this thing, because the benefit of the loan program now is that there's a face-to-face, look them in the eye, shake their hand relationship that allows that to go on, and that's the bond. And I'm afraid our legalese is going to break that bond. And once we do that, we have created a negative rather than a positive. And that's where I'm going on this thing, and I'm concerned about that.
Mr. Dabney, do you wish to respond, or
let me just both I think respond and provide closing comments. I appreciate the concerns that Representative Peterson has raised. They're the correct some of the correct concerns to have as we look at this industry. I would remind members that under the proposed bill, we essentially double the interest rate allowed for these consumer small loans. Between 1995 and 2003, 100% of consumer small loans in the state were done under 4760. It's only since 2003 that some of the companies operating in the state have moved to 4759, a statute that was never intended for the issuance of small consumer or payday loans. In that time, Payday America, in 2000, issued only 490 loans under 4760. In 2004, it issued 178,405 loans under 4760. Ms. Stone was correct. The intent of 4760 is to provide Minnesotans with safe, regulated, unsecured options for credit. That is the intent of this legislature. This bill merely returns payday lending to that safe, regulated, unsecured option under 4760, as intended.
Representative Kelsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had one question, and maybe in the time that we've been here it's been covered, but related to the military payday loan, the federal government, this sheet here says proposed rulemaking, but what they state, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe you've covered it, but for service members and their families, they're advocating for the protection from harmful products and practices, and so they limited it to 36%. Is that correct? And then, as a follow-up, do we know, I mean, these are thousands of people, do we know if they've been limited or precluded from getting payday loans because of the 36% limit?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi. This bill, 3533, does require payday lenders to inquire as to whether the borrower is a member of the active duty military and respond accordingly if they are. I would say your question goes better to Representative Simon's bill. This bill increases the interest rates payday lenders are allowed to charge under Minnesota statute. Representative Simon's bill would decrease it.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Do you have any concluding comments? If not, I would like you to move your motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3533
as amended.
Recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Simon, if you're not too angry with us, we'd love to have you come forth.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Members of the public, my apologies for running late today, but you know, when my to-do list gets long, I just keep pushing forward. Representative Benson, thank you for taking the chair for that last bill. Representative Simon, I see the good news is that you've just got a small bill here in front of us.
That's right.
So the chair would like to move, if I could find my cheat sheet. Thank you. House File 3511 to be before the committee, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know this has been a longer than expected session, so I'll try to be brief. I know the other testifiers will as well. This is the second, obviously, of the payday lending deals that we'll be considering today. This one's a little different. This one is quite simply a 36% APR, annual percentage rate cap. That's the bill. Cap at 36%. And what intrigued me about the bill and the reason I decided to carry the bill was that there's a precedent for this. And the precedent is very recent, and it's federal. And that's that Congress, within this calendar year, within 2008, in the last few weeks, enacted a statute now in law that says that with respect to military personnel and their families, as Representative Scalzi just alluded to, that's the cap, 36%, as to our men and women in uniform. And that got me thinking. If the Congress of the United States, at a time when we're at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and are asking a tremendous sacrifice of not only the members of the military, but their families, at that time, the Congress of the United States says that this is an exploitative practice, a predatory practice, and that we shouldn't subject the people who were asking to make that sacrifice to these kinds of practices, that got me thinking. It's certainly worth a discussion at the legislature. And although putting bills in the hopper shouldn't just be about having some sort of vague academic discussion, I'm very interested to hear, and I would submit that the committee ought to be as well, what folks have to say about that, and specifically what those in the industry have to say about that and themselves. So it's a 36% cap, and the bottom line argument from my standpoint, Mr. Chair and members, is that if that standard is good enough for the men and women that we're asking to go in harm's way and put their families in distress, why isn't it good enough for each and every one of us in all 50 states? Before the bill was enacted, the Pentagon itself, the Department of Defense, had labeled these practices predatory. And they obviously have a vested interest in looking out for the health and well-being and safety, financial and otherwise, of the men and women who are in uniform and putting themselves and their families at great risk. And that's really the bill. I understand we've heard a lot, including some very emotional testimony, obviously, from people who have benefited from this practice. And who are fans of it. And I don't deny, as Representative Peterson has said, and others know that from experience, that there's this need out there. But from what I understand about the industry, the testimony you heard today was the exception that proves the rule, that by far the vast majority of people take out multiple loans and are kind of in it for the long haul, and in many instances end up mired in something far deeper than they anticipated when they first got in. So I don't doubt that some people are helped by this, but I think we always have to do balancing and weighing around here, and some people may be helped, but the question is that worth continuing? And I don't want to be too flip about this, but I was thinking when I was getting ready for the testimony, and I'm not making a direct comparison, so I hope nobody's too offended by what I'm about to say, but you know, I don't doubt that there's a need for short-term cash, and I also don't doubt that in these cases there's a willing borrower and a willing lender. But there are lots of transactions where there are two willing parties that we ban, where there's a need. For example, again, I'm not making a direct comparison, but what if someone hung a sign outside and said, ladies and gentlemen, you only need one kidney, you have two, step right up for a kidney loan, and we'll take out a kidney or donate your organs, and that's a good need for short-term cash. I mean, I'm not trying to be funny about it, but there are a lot of ways people could get short-term cash, but we've seen fit to say that, no, you can't do that. Even though it's a willing buyer and a willing seller, so-called victimless transaction, we draw lines all the time. So I don't really buy the slippery slope argument we drive along all the time about what we can and can't do and what we will and won't permit. And I'm at the mercy of the committee. If you decide this goes too far, that's fine. But I want to be sensitive to that. There are a lot of ways people can get short-term cash, and we say no a lot. And all that this bill is intended to do is get us all to think about the fact at the Pentagon, and now the U.S. Congress, within the last several weeks, have both said that these are predatory practices, and the folks that we're relying on to protect our freedom should not be subject to them. And that really is affecting to me, and the reason why I agreed to carry this bill. 13 states have already banned payday lending, as has already been said, or have capped the interest rate at 36% or less than that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to turn it over to Aaron Anderson, who has something to say on the bill.
Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Aaron Anderson from Minnesota Acorn. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to have our testifier come up first. She has some time constraints, so I'll let her go first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Corrine Bowers. I would like to thank you for hearing my testimony. I think this legislation is very important, as it has affected me personally. It's difficult and embarrassing for me to tell you my story of the payday loan industry, but I am concerned about other Minnesotans that may fall into the same trap that I fell into with the payday loan establishment. Something I think we all have in common is low credit scores, poor financial management, and no place else to go for money. I was unable to get a secured loan from my credit union or overdraft protection because I have poor credit. And I saw an ad on TV for all you need is a checking account and a job, and you can have cash in your pocket tomorrow. The ads are really upbeat and fun. You can have money, free money to spend, you know, pay off the bill, you know, get your car fixed. And then you go to the store. I met all the requirements. They told me it was $10 per 100, which sounds reasonable to me. So I borrowed $300 the first time, which is $30 in interest every payday. So that's, I get paid twice a month, so every payday I have to give them $30 or I have to give them the $300 back plus the $30. Seeing as I didn't have the $300 in the first place when I borrowed it, I never had it to pay them back. So I constantly just kept paying back the $10 per hundred. And this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. Every time I got paid, I had to drive over there and give them $37, and then a new check for the original money that I borrowed, which they would hold. So that constituted a new loan each time, and that's how that was the loophole, that it wasn't the same loan. It was a new check every time. Then I got another loan for $500, and that was $20 for 100, which I used to. You have to remember that most of us are living paycheck to paycheck. So already I've got $45, $30 per check. That's $60 a month going out in fees. And I got another loan, which was $20 per 100, which was $100 per paycheck. And this is just, what it is just revolving debt. You just keep paying the fees. You never pay the principal. You don't have $500 to walk in there and pay the principal. So you're constantly in slavery to these payday loan companies. And I just found it to be, payday used to be, I used to dread payday. Instead of being excited about getting a paycheck, I would be, here we go again, look at my bank statement. And then the company that I borrowed $500 from never told me that they had an 8-week limitation. So then I go and look at my statement. There's $500 taken out, plus an additional $100 fee. So there's $600 taken automatically out of my bank account, and I don't have my rent money. So I go to two more payday loan establishments and get $250 each from them. Then I've got five sets of fees going at the same time, and it was just a total nightmare. I feel sorry for these people that are in such desperate straits that are, I'm sure they're barely making the fees. And I just, my heart goes out to anybody that gets stuck in that situation. Then I read in the Tribune that the payday loan industry was able to take you to conciliation court, and oftentimes they would get four times the amount of the money back that you borrowed, because they could get the subpoena costs, the fees in court. And I was looking at all these loans that I had for more than 9 months, every payday coming out of my paycheck. So I went and I closed my bank account. And then I started getting phone calls from the payday lenders telling me, we want our money, we want our money. And I'm like, I've paid you that loan back 3 times already, and you're telling me you want more money? And then I was worried I was going to go to conciliation court. To keep it short, I ended up filing bankruptcy in 2005, and that was the only way that I knew how to fend off the payday loan establishment. And I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. At the very least, if you can't outlaw them, I wish you would consider the proposition of capping the interest at 36%, because, like I'm saying, if you don't have $300, you're just going to pay the fees. And the loans pretty much don't ever get back. And if you do manage to pay back the loan, your car payment, you don't have your car payment. You don't have the grocery money. I mean, these kinds of loans are not for people that have money to pay back loans. They're for poor people and people who have really bad credit. And that I'm sorry, I will admit, is I am in that group. And since 2005, I haven't had any loans at all. No credit cards, nothing.
Thanks, Ms. Bauer.
You're welcome.
Representative Peterson.
And I'm sorry you have to tell us the story. But at the end, after you file bankruptcy, then the $500 loan to payday, they had to eat it. And
yeah, but I had already paid them $100. The one was $200 a month for like 9 months. Mm-hmm. And the principal never gets paid. If mm-hmm. there was a way, like a credit union, at least you're paying off the principal. Mm-hmm. But it's just revolving debt around and around. And it's really horrible. Like I said, you just dread payday.
Thank you, Ms. Powers.
You're welcome.
Representative Dunn.
Real quick, Mr. Chairman. Now that was in 2005 that you finally paid. And if I remember, the Federal Congress now has passed a new bankruptcy law. It'd be interesting. I'm sure we don't have, you know, access to information now, but whether or not you would even have that option under the new bankruptcy law, which would make the situation for borrowers even worse in the future.
Mr. Member, I filed right before they changed the law.
There was a rush, and I don't know if you qualified in that activity, but there was a rush of bankruptcy filings before the new law took effect because of the different circumstances under the new law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 3511? Representative Simon, I'm sorry.
Here, just before we go to that, if I might ask, I think Ms. Anderson just wanted to amplify a few comments. Very
quickly. Oh, my apologies. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll try and abbreviate my testimony, but you know, this bill addresses excessive APR allowed under Minnesota law for payday loans. And as you know, the APR can range from 194% all the way to 685%, depending on which statutes the payday lenders are using. The proposal to lower the APR to 36% is derived from the federal law that went into effect in October that limits the 36% APR on payday loans that payday lenders can charge on active duty military personnel and their families. And in your packets, we have the thing that Representative Sullivan was referring to. The Department of Defense asked Congress to rein in these outrageous loans, and for payday loans, which the Department of Defense characterized as predatory and seeking to deceive service members or take advantage of them in a time of vulnerability. It seems that there's little logic in protecting our soldiers from payday loans while allowing the same person, when they leave the service and become a veteran, to be gouged for the very same transaction. Not only that, but we believe that all citizens deserve the same protection. As you heard from lobbyists, reducing the rate to 36% would drive the businesses out of state and deprive people of access to the short-term credit that they need. But in fact, Minnesota and Minnesotans would be better off without them. The North Carolina study that's in your packets as well stated that the absence of these lenders had no significant impact on the availability of the credit for households in North Carolina. Had a positive rather than a negative effect on their lives. As Representative Simon said, the 13 states have already banned or capped these payday loans, and citizens of these states seem to be getting along just fine without them. In fact, North Carolina Banking Study found that borrowers found alternatives such as credit cards, which have reasonable APRs, friends, relatives, and being more proactive with creditors working out repayments for their debt. You also heard from the payday lobbyists that you can't apply APR to two-week loans. That would be correct if each borrower only took out one loan for 2 weeks. But in fact, the fact of the industry is that the vast majority of borrowers take out multiple loans each year. And although Minnesota doesn't keep statistics on serial borrowing, other states do. And according to one report also in your packet, and as Representative Gaffney said, 90% take out 5 or more each year, 60% 12 or more each year, and then 24 take out 21 or more loans each year. And so with this long-term relationship, the application of APR is perfectly reasonable. In fact, one whistleblower in the industry identified the industry's business model, and he said, I quote, "We train our sales staff to keep customers dependent, to make sure they keep reborrowing forever if possible. This is not a single transaction. This is a transaction designed to keep the borrowers coming back over and over again and again. So applying APR is appropriate."
Ms. Anderson, is that appropriate conclusion for your statement?
No.
Is that appropriate conclusion for your comments? I'm just sensitive to time.
Yeah, that's... I can, yeah.
Thank
I'm,
you for that.
There's a lot of other stuff has already been said. So.
Yes.
And there's a lot of information in your packet as well.
Thank you very much. I assume that a fair amount of the testimony on the previous bill applies broadly to this bill as well. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify against House File 3511? Ms. Stone, welcome back.
Thank you.
So thumbs up, thumbs down, Ms. Stone.
Pardon me,
thumbs up, thumbs down.
Well, thumbs down. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Remy Stone, I'm an attorney, and I also am an employee with Advance America, the bank and Boston payday lender. We do not operate in the state of Minnesota, however, we would like to someday. This bill, obviously, 36% APR is Minnesota nice to say we're going to ban this product in Minnesota. When you hear the advocates talk about how many states have banned payday lending, the reality is that there has not been legislation to affirmatively ban us. What has happened is we've had these passive-aggressive approaches to regulate us out of operation, or we've had been sunsetted, or we've just not adopted enabling legislation to let this product go forward. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, you've heard it all before. APR is the wrong tool. And Representative Shelby, you asked about military lending. My company stopped lending to military personnel in October of 2006. This is consistent nationally where payday lenders do not lend to military personnel. The irony is just last year in Ohio, we had a military person threaten publicly to sue us for discrimination because we chose to comply with Congress's 36% APR or the Department of Defense's 36% APR. They do not have access to this product, period.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. I appreciate the brevity. Representative Scalzi.
Then the follow-up to that would be, are military families and their dependents not getting any loans anywhere, and why don't we read about that? I mean, there must be somewhere else where they're turning. So they're not buying your product, but they must be turning somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. We've had this war of reports here today. The CRL's report is good or the Federal Reserve's report is good. The reality is that we know that they are turning somewhere. They're either turning underground, which is the reason why we created that statute here. They're either bouncing checks. They are going to their credit unions if they're fortunate enough to have the credit to be able to get that type of product. Or, and Mr. Chairman, I just have to tell you this, they are going to the Internet. And while we may want to think that we can regulate offshore Internet lending or anybody who's not licensed and not regulated on the Internet, we're fooling ourselves. My company does not do Internet lending. Some of my peers do. When they do and they have a license, they comply with the license statutes in those states.
But they'll go offshore, and they'll go to Costa Rica. They will go to the Caymans. They will go anywhere for this product if they have that short-term financial crisis before them.
Is anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 3511? Mr. Rickman, again, please introduce yourself to the tape. We are recorded for, believe it or not, historical purposes.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Again, Brad Rickman, owner of Payday America. I'd like to also concur with Remy that the payday lenders who were in a position to lend to military officers have since ceased that type of activity. And I also agree that 36% interest effectively will put my company out of business, and we will not be making loans to the thousands of Minnesota residents that use our services on an annual basis. The individual who testified earlier testified about being charged $20 per hundred on a $500 loan, and that's and she also implied that a rollover was most likely made in that instance. Rollovers have never been allowed in the state in Minnesota, regardless if you're operating as an industrial loan or thrift company. We do not allow that, or a consumer small lender. A $500 loan in Wisconsin or in South Dakota or North Dakota costs $600 if you're going to pay off that loan on your payday. So that is a $100 fee. Under the industrial loan and thrift, our fees are $40, so we are effectively 60% less than these other states where people will be forced to go to. Internet lending is widely unregulated. There are fees as high as 30%. So we believe that under the industrial loan and thrift, and as how we operate right now, number one, we are very competitive, but also offer a fair rate. And we would like to stay in business and offer Minnesotans product which we're proud of.
Mr. Rickman, you just testified that, if I followed you correctly, the allowable interest rate or fee structure in North Dakota, was it?
In North Dakota, I believe it's $20 for the first 100.
Okay. So theirs is higher than ours.
Well, yes, they have a payday law, and then they have lowering fees, and they do have some other restrictions. But and Wisconsin is unregulated.
Okay. Can you identify what percentage of your client base comes from either North Dakota or Wisconsin to Minnesota to access payday loans at a more competitive rate?
I did, in the short notice, we had our customers sign postcards, we've only had a couple of days. And I did notice, looking through the 150 postcards which were signed since yesterday morning to until today, that there were some customers from Wisconsin who came to Minnesota. It is not a large number because the population of Hudson is maybe 15,000, and we don't have the cards from Superior, Wisconsin, which is where our Duluth store is located. Our Duluth store is not located in Superior. we don't have those cards yet, but I know there are customers that come to us from Wisconsin because we do charge lower fees. Our product, again, is a one-year line of credit. So a customer comes in and is approved for a one-year line of credit, and they can take in advance and pay off as they need throughout the year. So it's a lot different than a customer writing a paycheck every 2 weeks.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rickman.
Thank you.
Mr. Tapper?
Stuart Tapper with representing Minnesota Financial Service Center. Our company doesn't do loans under 4760 a year. However, we do have members that do operate under 4760. And I just wanted to reiterate and agree with some of the earlier testimony you've heard, but it would effectively put them out of business. They would then make the, it would be just not financially feasible for them to operate under those rates. So it would effectively kill the product in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Tapper. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 3511? Seeing none, Representative Simon, any closing comments?
You know, other than that, I think this is a discussion that I think would be fruitful in the full Commerce
Committee, and it's a very interesting issue as to why both the Pentagon and now Congress have deemed this to be exploitation of our military personnel. I think it's a very fair question to ask why all of us and our families aren't deserving of the same level of protection.
Thank you, President Peterson.
Again, here's my concern. Again, your bill's coming second after we've just spent 2 hours on 3533, and then this comes in and disembowels that. I can't quite figure out what's happening here.
Gosh, you put it like that, it sounds a little scary.
I know, but I mean, am I wrong, Professor Cox, or Professor Elwood, or Professor Fender? I mean, why do we spend all that time on 3533? I thought that was a very healthy discussion and coming up with a good product, and then this comes along and just knocks the pins right out. This just takes it off the table.
Reverend Peterson,
your bill.
Good point. Maybe I can speak to that. I think there's a couple of approaches you could think of. It's not unusual when an issue is raised for multiple legislators to have different perspectives on an approach, a solution, a strategy towards the issue. I think that's number one. Number two, I think these you could also see these as complementary. One, moving everyone under the appropriate statute when they're not currently, and then perhaps a debate here on what the interest rate allowable should be once we get them under the statute that was right. Intended
but,
for them.
And I understand it, and I represent Debbie, and I don't want to be, but the part of your bill moved their regulations from section 47.59 into 47.60, and then you come right next bill and you take 47.60 and now you put the slammer on them with the rate. And maybe it's just coincidental that I'm seeing this happen sequentially. But that's why I looked at it, Representative Simon, as a horse and a saddle. You come in, put the rule in, take it from 47.59 into 47.60, and then you come in and take 47.60, and bam, you hit it with a 36 APR. Done. So I can just pass a bill that outlaws it. Did the same thing.
If I may, Representative Simon, I would remind the members that up until 2003, all payday loans were done under 4760. It's only at that time that four of the 25 companies that do payday loans in the state shifted over to industrial loan and thrift. And now 70% of the loans in the state are being made under the wrong statute. And so I think we've got different approaches here, perhaps contradictory, perhaps complementary, that'll be for the committee to decide on how to bring both the lending back under the statute that the legislature created for it and to look at the issue that Representative Simon created or stated that if our active duty military personnel are exploited by an interest rate above 36%, is that any different for veterans or others and other citizens of Minnesota? Representative Simon?
Well put, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments or questions on House File 3511? Seeing none, the Chair renews his motion that House File 3511 be recommended to pass. The Chair renews his motion that House File 3511 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Members of the public and audience, and members, thank you for your time today. I apologize for running so late. We stand adjourned.